Meeting will come to order. Representative Erdahl has House File 865. Representative Erdahl moves House File 865. And whoever you would like, if you're having Amy Wild join you at the table, Amy Wild can come forward, and any other testifier if you want someone else to join you there. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Madam Chair, committee members, and enjoy this opportunity to present the case for Greenleaf State Park with you today. The Department of Natural Resources initiated the concept of a new state park between Litchfield and Hutchinson in Meeker County back in about 2000 after being contacted by citizen groups. And we have some of our citizens with us today from the Greenleaf area, Meeker County, who are concerned about this particular issue and here supporting it. Would the folks from Meeker County please stand up?
Welcome to the committee. It is wonderful to have you, and of course, what a great day to be out, and we're happy to have you here.
Between 2000 and 2003, numerous meetings were held in the area under the direction of the DNR. In 2003, a proposed state park at Greenleaf was established. In 2004, the word proposed was removed, and in 2005, we approved $500,000 in the bonding bill to begin the purchase of land for the park. Meeker County pledged to add another $300,000. This land matches DNR criteria for state parks. The DNR identified this spot as one of the only areas excluding Indian reservations that has no state park within 30 miles. Note the dot in the center of your map. That's Meeker County in Greenleaf. We would like to purchase 300-plus acres now. About 1,200 acres are contained in the park boundary. We don't know how many acres the final park will be. We are also urging a plan that may consider other uses of the land, conservation district, wildlife management areas, etc. The county doesn't expect any development for 10 years, and in fact, will involve themselves in maintenance expenses in the interim. This land is little more than an hour away from nearly 3 million people. It contains native vegetation and is undeveloped. We need to make the purchases now while the land is available. It isn't getting any cheaper. Meeker County has placed a six-month moratorium on development, but we can't hold out much longer. Development will happen. Pat Arndt, the former state parks planner, described the Greenleaf Lake area as beautiful, very well suited to park development. DNR Representative Jeff Sieve said, "We have regular opportunities in northern Minnesota. In fact, most have been there, but a development like this is pretty rare. In fact, it might not come around again." Former DNR Commissioner Alan Garber wrote, "While our first obligation is to the existing system, I feel we would be remiss if we did not continue to have a vision for expanding the system to meet the needs of future generations. So with that understanding, I authorize State Park and DNR staff to assist you in continuing to explore the possibility of a state park on Greenleaf Lake." Now, I've heard short-sighted people claim, why should the DNR do another park? They can't afford what they have now. First, development cost for the next 10 years is minimal. Second, where is the vision for the future? This spot is within an hour of nearly 3 million people, with another 2 million projected within 20 years. Think of the carbon imprint on this. Instead of driving hundreds of miles, people can drive 60 miles to enjoy pristine recreational land. Third, the core of the park is about $3 million. The seller will sell over time if the state wishes. The state's share, frankly, won't be that much. But even if it was, I think it's a cheap investment in our future and the environment. And fourth, millions of dollars are being requested to add new parkland where we already have parks. We're asking to begin a purchase where there is none. I want to thank the DNR for all they have done up to this time. In summary, this park was initiated by the DNR. It is a state park in statute. $500,000 has been set aside for land purchase. We need to make that purchase and add to it before the land is sold for development. So, thank you. Amy Wild, the Meeker County Commissioner.
Ms. Wild, would you like to offer additional comments?
Yes. Good afternoon. Thank you, Madam Chair, for this opportunity. I'm Meeker County Commissioner Amy Wild from DASL. And the proposed park that's been designated lies within my district. About 8 years ago, the state approached Meeker and McLeod County leaders regarding the lack of a state park in our area. We were asked to recommend undeveloped natural areas which included Lakeshore. The Greenleaf Sioux Cedar Lake complex was identified. Located a dozen miles from Hutchinson and a dozen miles from Litchfield, it is not heavily developed, and much of it is marginal farmland. There was pristine lakeshore, woods, and abundant wildlife, a rarity this close to the Twin Cities area. Early inquiries identified landowners who were willing to sell. And when state officials visited, they agreed the location was unique and should be preserved. Now, having said this, a new park is not always well received. Some people think there are enough parks, and that counties and townships should not remove private land from the tax rolls. And they, you know, some country folks think about outsiders coming in and bristle a little. And it takes study and thought to identify tourism and recreational potential to offset the rather small revenue loss. But after numerous meetings, most local officials supported the concept. We cooperated when the legislator set boundaries for Greenleaf Park and the legislator allocated $500,000 toward land acquisition. Since $500,000 doesn't go very far, the Meeker County has offered and is still willing to offer a $300,000 loan to the Parks and Trails Group, which purchases prime land until state money is released. That way, $800,000 could immediately go toward land acquisition. You should understand that this offer is null if the state does not begin the process of acquiring land, since a farm-based county like Meeker does not have sufficient tax base to support an additional county park. We already have 10 county parks, most of them very small. Only three of our parks are large enough for trails and any wildlife habitat, and only one of our county parks offers any camping whatsoever. Our county board and the willing land sellers are disappointed that the $500,000 allocated by the legislature 2 years ago has not been released. A couple owners really want to sell the land, and they're beginning to talk about selling it to someone else and possibly having it developed. Both Hutchinson and Litchfield are growing, and there is a big demand for rural residential property. To give the state additional time to take action towards securing land for a future state park or recreational area, the Meeker County Board placed a moratorium on developing the land until June 12th of this year. After that, we feel these landowners should be able to exercise their building entitlements like other rural county landowners. It's a fairness issue. Just recently, I learned that the Department of Natural Resources wants a plan to be developed for the area. Since the state had approached us and not the other way around, we had assumed the DNR would develop a plan. Indeed, one was done in 2002. Well, although another plan or a revised plan may make sense, I've been told there's already consensus that the lakeshore adjacent to a current public access is the most important parcel to acquire for either a state park or recreational area. Since we should keep this project rolling forward, I will encourage my fellow commissioners to participate in such a plan, and it's my understanding that our Regional Development Commission, and this is our director sitting here next to me, is also willing, and perhaps even McLeod County. However, unless the state takes action to acquire property, I will not encourage our county to spend money on further study. My points are this. Number one, there's a general agreement that this land deserves to be protected. Several area landowners have been cooperative, but their patience is wearing thin. Meeker County offered $300,000 in addition to the $500,000, but this offer is only good if the state actually buys land. I will encourage my board to participate in a study, but only if the core land is first secured by the state. And fourthly, if the DNR further delays releasing and spending the $500,000, after June 12th, the temporary county moratorium will expire, and there is a chance that the property owner will begin executing the standard county building entitlements on the land. Our county board has devoted time and staff resources towards assisting the state in developing this park, and it's not realistic for the DNR or the state to expect either the county or the landowners to wait longer. Thank you. And I believe I'm going to let Don Winkler tag in here.
Mr. Winkler, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, representatives. Again, my name is Don Winkler. I am the Executive Director of the Mid-Minnesota Regional Development Commission. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of Representative Erdahl's bill. One of the goals of the 2000 Minnesota State Park System Land Study is to have a state park facility within 30 miles of every state resident. The Greenleaf State Park site falls outside of 30 miles from any existing state park or state recreation area. The two nearby regional centers of Hutchinson and Litchfield are also not within a 30-mile drive distance from any state park facility. Greenleaf State Park would help achieve the state goal of closing one of the few remaining geographic gaps in the state park system. The site for Greenleaf State Park is an ideal setting for a park. The site is a transition zone between the Big Woods Forest and Prairie. The site is located within approximately 10 miles of both the cities of Hutchinson and Litchfield, and just over 60 miles from the Minneapolis-St. Paul metropolitan area. The area is currently underdeveloped, but without moving to purchase land soon to protect it for a future park, it is very likely the site will be lost to development. Finding another location to meet state goals of residents being within 30 miles of a state park would be very difficult at best, as this whole area of the state is being so close to the Twin Cities is under rapid growth development. This area of Meeker County has seen strong growth in residential development. In 2006, Ellsworth Township, which the site is located, had 31 new building permits issued. The township's population has increased nearly 64% from 1970 until 2005. From 1990 to 2000, there has been a 22% increase in population in the township, or 154 persons. The township is growing much faster than Meeker County as a whole. And again, I want to emphasize how the cities of Litchfield and Hutchinson are also growing in the area. So it won't be long before, if this land isn't there for a park, it will be snapped up for residential development. I hope this presentation of these facts will help demonstrate that this committee that this is an important bill, and with a window of opportunity that will not stay open much longer to preserve this unique property for the public good. Thank you.
Representative Jumke has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and it's good to see you're saving money on pins, Representative Erdahl. So that's a good. You're frugal people over in Meeker County. We appreciate that. But my real question is. The commissioner, who I know very well, has said that the $500,000 hasn't been released yet. Now you're asking for $1 million more. I guess my question to you and Senator Dill, who's sitting up here so diligently, is why hasn't Governor Plenty given you the $500,000 that was previously appropriated, and what guarantees do you have from him to release the $1 million if we put it in? That seems to be problematic in itself. Do you have an explanation for that one?
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Representative Jahnke. It's a bit of a conundrum. All that I can see for that is that DNR commissioner, Commissioner Holston, is advising the governor not to. Frankly, I don't even know if they talk about Greenleaf. I mean, basically,
do they talk about you, Representative Erdahl? That's a question.
I do. But at this point, I think that Commissioner, if the governor is aware of this, he is heeding the advice of Commissioner Holston.
Well, and again, Madam Chair and Representative Erdahl, it's a serious question because I see the assistant commissioner sitting here today in the audience, and I wonder if you've had someone explain to you why that money has not been released yet.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Basically, and I certainly do ask this question, the answer is we can't afford what we have now. Why should we do anything more? And I gave four reasons why they should. Another one that I don't really get a good answer for is because the state of Minnesota told you to. I mean, the people of Minnesota, through their elected representatives, have said to the DNR, you should use $500,000 to begin the purchase of Greenleaf. When I broached that question to the governor's office, and I did speak with the chief of staff last week, I said that to him, and I said also, as I had indicated to you, that if you can't afford what you have now, why are you spending millions of dollars or asking for millions of dollars to build parks or to buy land at parks where they are already in existence? And he really didn't have an answer.
And, Madam Chair, one last question. Has the governor or the DNR, his commissioner, indicated to you what that cost would be? Because you're asking for, again, just to purchase land. I don't know that you've asked yet for money for development. Your critical issue now is to protect and realize that land purchase. I mean, development may be 5 years, 7 years, whatever years.
Representative Junkie, I'm sure. Again, it could be 10 years. I mean, the county actually has a resolution saying we don't expect anything within 10 years. So we're trying to put off that development. The question becomes, is the DNR and the state of Minnesota willing, are they saying, we're not going to have another state park? I mean, that's the crux of it, really. Are we saying that we have no vision for the future, that we will never have enough money to operate our parks? If that's the attitude, I think we need to change it.
Members, all of the bills today will be held over for possible inclusion, and you've educated us well, and we thank the community of around Greenleaf Lake State Park for taking the time to come to our committee today. They're certainly welcome to stay for the entire meeting if they'd like, but we thank you for the quick education.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes. Just briefly, we're certainly willing to, be working with the DNR. We need to. There are some positive ideas. I think I talked with some DNR officials today, and I'm looking forward to being able to work through this and do some compromising and continue the dream of this park.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Saylor. The first two bills, by the way, members, were on a previous agenda, and it turned out to be a complicated hearing, and they both agreed to come back today, so we thank them for their patience. Representative Saylor, I will move House File 858, and you have with you Jerry Stenzing.
I do.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. We can't compete with half of the audience standing up, but we do have the one person from Beltrami that did get in the plane and come down, which doesn't by any magnitude tell us how many people actually support this, but it does speak to how many can come down. At any rate, I know this is not news to many of you, but we will go through just a brief overview. You have some handouts, and you have some others coming around right now that may just shed a little more light on this for you. Just an overview to say that the Big Bog State Recreation Area is a mile-long boardwalk into the heart of the patterned peatlands. And for those of you that have not had the opportunity to go, I would certainly recommend it. It's quite a unique experience. But this allows visitors a chance to walk out on the largest peat bog in the lower 48 states. And walking on a peat bog is something you definitely want to do on one of these boardwalks, not walking through it. In addition to the bog walk, we also have the campground, which is located between the Tamarack River and Upper Red Lake, which is becoming, again, a premier fishing destination in the state of Minnesota. I would like to also add that the State Recreation Area and Park were authorized in the year 2000. And originally, when the Big Bog project started, it was in 2000, and they were given initially half of the funding and told to come back next year for the remainder of the funding. We are now 7 years down the road, and next year continues in the continuing calendar of finishing up the funding for the Big Bog. I would just draw your attention to the Bog Walk brochure. I think it says more than I could say just by merely looking at the photos of this wonderful state recreation area. You can't even begin to imagine how many things you can see when you just stand on this boardwalk looking at it. And if park manager Doug Easthouse is there, he will tell you of thousands of things you never would imagine were there. But this is a wonderful opportunity not only for the people in the state of Minnesota to in protection of a great resource, and also the educational factor. People come from all over the world to study in this Big Bog. The funding is the same as it has been, $1.6 million, the request, and that would be $1.3 for the contact station upgrade with the interpretive center and the fire tower relocation. I will let Jerry Stensig give the details on that since he knows them very, very well. I'll just mention that the other $250,000 are for other park development, including the historic fish hatchery, and $50,000 for forest restoration and interpretation at Ludlow Island. And that island, by the way, is within the peatlands, not in the lake. So with no further comments from me, I will turn this over to Jerry Stensing, who knows it very, very well. Thank you.
Mr. Stensing, please identify yourself for the record.
Madam Chair. Jerry Stensing. I live at 28932 Sunny Beach Road in Sunny Beach Road Northeast in Waskish. That's a mouthful. They changed it from P.O. Box 14. I'm the vice chair of the Friends of the Big Bog. I've been working on this project for 7-8 years now. I think this is about the seventh time I've been down to testify on behalf of Big Bog in our endeavors to obtain funding to finish building the park. Again, Brita had passed out some handouts here, and draw your attention to the first one with the history on it. In the year 2000, the park was created, a little over 9,000 acres. We had originally asked for $4.3 million. They gave us a little over $2 million, and said, come back next year for the other half. Well, we came back the next year, and we passed both the House and the Senate. It was in the bonding package, and then Governor Ventura vetoed it. Well, in 2004, we came down again, and we passed both the House and the Senate, but then there was a deadlock, and there was no bonding passed that year. So in 2005, we came down again, and requesting the same amount to do the same things. And in conference committee, there were some concerns by the Department of Natural Resources over operational costs. And I would like to draw your attention to the attendance and revenue summary, the graph. A little history. In the heyday of walleye fishing on Red Lake, that campground had 10,000 annual overnight stays. Now, last year, in 2006, we had 9,941. So that's a tremendous recovery. Not all those people camping there are going fishing. The revenues generated by this park, $92,910. That pays for all the positions except for the park manager. That's one staff position to run that entire park that it's costing the state. The rest is self-sufficient. Now, when we finish building this park, our visitation should be almost double what it is right now. And I would strongly encourage this committee to go ahead and move this forward for bonding, because we need to see what this baby can do. We finished building it, and we're going to have a lot more visitation. We're seeing people nationally, some international tourists. It's a brand new park, and I just can't say enough about how well this park has worked, what it's done with the original investment. Well, the numbers are here. So in 05, I think we've addressed the operational issues. In 06, we were back last year again, and it died in conference committee. There were other state priorities that overrode us. It's not saying that Big Bog wasn't important. It just wasn't as important as some of the others. And that's part of the reason why we're down here this year in a non-bonding year, is because next year in the regular bonding session, there's going to be a lot of bigger priorities. I sat in committee hearings here in years past, and I heard stories from people about issues that I almost got up and walked out and said, geez, I can't justify asking for money for this when these other issues are out here. But in a nutshell, we've got great community participation. A lot of effort and time and energy has gone into this. It is truly a success story, and it is a good investment in the state of Minnesota. It's a good investment in northern Minnesota. And with that, I would be happy to answer any questions.
Members, I had occasion to visit this area, and observed that probably it was very dramatically different from season to season, and I was told it's very different, dramatically different from week to week, that every time you go out there, in fact, there is something new to see. Any questions? If not, we thank you for coming down such a long way and presenting the bill and educating us. There are many new members on this committee, so the additional education was helpful.
Well, thank you very much for
again,
the opportunity.
Again, this bill will be laid over.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
I think we're going to take Representative Hamilton, because Representative Solberg wanted to be here, and I think he is not here yet. So, Representative Hamilton, if you would come forward. We're switching the order a bit. House File 1646.
Sure. Madam Chair, I'd like to move that House File 1646 be moved for possible inclusion.
Representative Hamilton, welcome to the committee.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. With the House File that we're talking about here, is we had language in the 2006 bonding bill to allocate money to help clean up an old dilapidated building in the city of Worthington that's commonly referred to the Campbell Soup Building. And we can have our guests here comment more on that. We were successful, thanks to many of you, to secure $800,000 to help with that cleanup. That was the total dollar amount for the cleanup. Of course, we are not a wealthy district, that's no secret. And so in order to do this, we needed the entire dollar amount. What ended up happening is in the section of the bill, there was another provision in there for the city of Winona. And after that, it talked about this grant is exempt from the requirements of Minnesota statutes. Section 116J, et cetera, et cetera, which does not ask for the matching funds. So, again, we were successful to secure all the dollars, the total dollar amount, but that one provision was left out to where it's requiring us now, in essence, to secure matching funds, which we do not have. And so we're just looking to clarify that and come back to you to add that provision back in if we could. And I do have a couple members from Worthington City Council to testify to, Madam Chair.
And do you have additional testimony? Or are you here for questions, or what would you would you like?
Lyle Tenhaken, City Council in Worthington. Rod summed it up very well. We're just looking for corrective language to take away some of the confusion that may have occurred in the last year's legislative session. So, quite honestly, it's a corrective measure that we're asking for, and we appreciate your considering this matter.
And Mr. Parker, anything?
Mike Wolf from City Council of Worthington. No,
not
just here to show support. Thank
okay.
you.
Okay. There appear to be no questions, and so we thank you for coming and presenting the bill. Any final comments?
I just want to say thank you, Madam Chair and members. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Anzell.
Now we get to the big part.
Representative Solberg.
Around the range.
Madam Chair, I would move that House File 25, small number, be recommended pass and possible inclusion in the
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This is the request for infrastructure dollars for the Minnesota Steel and Iron Project to be located on the western Mesabi near the community of Nashwauk in the county of Itasca, which is one of the five or six poorest counties in our great state in terms of per capita income. To my left is Ron Dicklich, former state senator, whom most of you know. He is the infrastructure project manager for Itasca County. And it's a privilege to introduce to you a gentleman whom most of you have not met, Mr. John Elmore, who is the president and CEO of Minnesota Steel and Iron. And the three of us will explain the request, but at the outset, I'd like to just share a paragraph about the project itself. This is a project of $1.6 million of private investment, $1.6 billion of private investment in the western Mesabi. It is literally a signal of the rebirth of the Mesabi Range's iron ore, taconite, and now steel making capability. This will be the first mill on the Great Mesabi to, in fact, make steel. The project and the proposal would eventually employ over 750 workers, and I'm sure that number strikes you as something significant. And if you could come to the Mesabi Iron Range, especially the western Mesabi, you would see mines that have ceased operation. And frankly, the site of this steel mill will be where we lost the taconite processing facility in 1986. Switching to the proposal before us, as I said, it's for infrastructure. It will bring the state's commitment to this project to $53 million when you add what Representative Solberg and others here in the legislature were able to do for this project in the 06 session. The appropriation is for rail, road, gas, and electric service associated with the steel mill. There will be a close partnership in the infrastructure development between Itasca County and the community of Nashwauk, which will be the host community. With that, unless my colleagues have additional comments, we're certainly willing to address any questions the committee might have.
Representative Mahoney.
Madam Chair, I'm just wondering, do you stay an Iron Range freshman until you come up with a $30 million bonding project?
This is the thing.
Madam Chair,
what you
do is you pass it off to someone else who has the district now that used to have the district before.
Well done, well done.
Either of the gentlemen, either Mr. Dicklish or Mr. Elmore. Yes.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thanking the legislature for their support last year, and this, of course, would complete what I think is the public's commitment to almost $1.6 billion project of bringing public infrastructure services such as rail, gas, and electric to the project. They utilize about 500 megawatts of electricity and more gas than I can even count. And then also the rail is needed to be able to get there are over 2.5 million tons of steel to the markets that are in demand of this project. We're excited about this project in Itasca County. It was June 10th, 1985, actually, when Representative Solberg and I stood on the parking lot that last day when Butler Tackett ended up. And I remember it was a rainy day, and it was gloomy enough, and that was much more gloomy when those people drove out that last time. So we're excited about this project. As said, Representative Anzalk said, and we'll have about 700 employees and another 2,100 spin-off employees, which is a huge economic impact for an area that hasn't had industrial development for well over 25 years.
Madam Chair? Representative
Solberg. Maybe I could just ask one question for clarification from Mr. Elmore, and that is how much private money has been invested into the project so far, roughly? Mr. Elmore,
Mr. Elmore, please identify Solberg, yourself
sure.
for the record.
To date.
Would you, just for the record, please identify yourself?
Sure. Madam Chair, Representatives, I'm John Elmore. I'm the President and CEO of Minnesota Steel. To date, and by the time we hit financial close, Representative Solberg, it will be about $82 million of private money that's been invested in this project to date.
And is there another testifier? No. We have a DNR name?
Well, Marty Vitas, Madam Chair, I think is here for questions if he wants.
Okay.
If you want.
And there appear to be no questions. Representative Tingleston.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Anzell, I think last year this got like $12 million in bonding. Can you give me a little bit of history of those bonds been let? How does that fit in the process? And are you requesting funding for this year or for next year?
Representative Anzell.
Madam Chair and Representative Tingleston, the 06 session of the legislature appropriated, I believe, $12 million in bonding money, and none of those dollars other than an initial $4 million has been expended, and that's been expended on design, pre-planning, and work leading up to the major infrastructure work which will take place in calendar years 07 and 08.
Representative Tingleston.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So just to follow up on that then, Representative Anzell, so you need additional funding this year then to progress with some of the bonding that was approved last year, is that right?
Madam Chair and Representative Tingleston, the $30 million request the committee has in front of it today will largely complete the state's commitment in infrastructure to support the $1.6 billion in private investment.
Representative Solberg.
Just a point of clarification, besides the $12 million in bonding that was given last year, there was $11 million also in cash.
Okay.
The total request of this project has been $53 million. It's been around for a couple of years of infrastructure. They have received $23 million of it previously. And then to answer your second question, It is kind of critical that we have it this year because of we expect financial closure, and this is important to be able to have that financial closure this year as they do the financing of this project.
Madam Chair and members, additionally, tomorrow evening is a very important milestone in the development of this project, because in the community of Nashwauk, the Minnesota DNR will be conducting a draft EIS, a public comment meeting, where the public will be testifying on the project, and the permitting is proceeding rapidly, and we're very hopeful that this project will come to fruition in 07.
Any further questions? If not, thank you for
the
bill
much.
Presentation, and the bill will be laid over. Is Representative Erdahl in the room? Representative Scalzi is waiting for one additional testifier. Yes, we think he's out in the hall, and I think we're going to take his... We moved a little faster than everyone thought, so. Okay. The other testifier is here, so we can proceed with Representative Scalzi. Representative Scalzi moves House File 28. Members, to set the context for this one, you may recall in the last couple of years, Representative Bernardi bringing a bill forward for Medtronic. And here was a situation where a community had a company that wanted to expand and provide additional jobs and expansion for the area, but they needed infrastructure help from the state, and that bill was brought before us. As you will learn today, we have a similar circumstance that Representative Scalzi will talk to us about.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And for the record, I'm Bev Scalzi, representative from Little Canada, Vadnais Heights, Roseville, Shoreview. And you've already moved the bill, Madam Chair?
You moved it.
Okay. Thank you. This is a jobs bill. We call this a jobs bill because it's the type of bill that we need in the state to increase our biomedical industry. The bill is for $2 million for planning, design, and engineering of the Rice Street Bridge. Our transportation infrastructure, in this case, hasn't kept up with the needs of the growth of Minnesota's biomedical industry, and that's why we're here today. We did introduce this bill last year, and we didn't get funding on it, and we do have resolutions from the three cities involved, Little Canada, Maplewood, and Roseville, and we also have a resolution from Ramsey County in support of this project.
And Representative Scalzi, if you would leave those with the committee, we'll put them on file with the project.
I will do that. Thank you, Ms. Chair. St. Jude Medical has its world headquarters just a mere 6 miles north of the Capitol, and it has two facilities there at the Rice Street Bridge. One is north of Highway 36, and one is south of Highway 36. This bridge that crosses Highway 36 is a two-lane bridge. It's rated F by the Ramsey County traffic engineer. You can actually see rebar on it, which is not good. The three cities in the area, Ramsey County, Little Canada, Maplewood, and Roseville, have all been working on this project for approximately a year. Now, the planned expansion is for another St. Jude Medical facility, but it's impacted by the company's inability to move customers, visitors, and employees across the deficient bridge. But we have here with us today Jeff Drews, who's the facilities manager of St. Jude Medical, and he'll speak to the committee about the planned expansion and some of their future goals. And we also have Joel Hansen, who's the city administrator of Little Canada, and he'll detail some other state and local efforts to assist traffic movement in this congested area.
Mr. Drews, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. For the record, my name is Jeff Drews, and I am the Senior Manager of Facilities for St. Jude Medical. I'd like to offer St. Jude Medical support to the matter before the committee today to fund the design phase of the project to replace the bridge over Highway 36. We are one of many businesses in the area whose employees, visitors, customers, experience daily traffic problems associated with the transportation infrastructure in this area. We believe that the current infrastructure represents both a safety and a quality of life issue and is a factor for us in considering the pace of our expansion plans in the area. With respect to the Rice Street Bridge, we opened a 100,000 square foot expansion of our cardiovascular division last year on the south side in the Maplewood area in our Woodridge Technology Center. This allowed expansion in the division and freed up space to move our number of positions from the corporate headquarters into the Woodridge site and to allow additional headcount expansion at the headquarters site. In all, we estimate the expansion has increased pressure on their already stressed transportation infrastructure. St. Jude Medical is currently evaluating an additional site in the area for possible expansion for our atrial defibrillation division, our fastest growing business. We envision the primary professional research and development, engineering, and additional professional positions may be based at this new site. Approximately 350 employees could occupy phase one of the project with expansion room for approximately this many more. A serious concern in evaluating this site in the pace of any expansion plan that might put in place is the current state of the transportation infrastructure. The current timeline to replace the bridge by 2024 simply will not support the growth of the company. We sincerely hope that you will consider funding the design phase of the project now so the progress can potentially be made at a faster pace. With regard to Minnesota as home, in a place where we would like to consider additional expansion in coming years, we look forward to continuing to work with you toward that end. Thank you.
And Mr. Hansen from Little
Madam Canada. Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much for the opportunity to talk about this important project. As has been outlined, St. Jude Medical is an important...
And perhaps just for the record, you could state
name and my name is Joel Hansen. I'm the city administrator in Little Canada. Thank you. St. Jude Medical is an important player in our community and in the Northeast Metro area and in the state of Minnesota. The need to facilitate this new bridge to help them grow and expand areas is of paramount importance. To aid in that, Little Canada has been working on our local issues where we've improved the street on the B2 front edge, which is on the north side of 36, that try and make traffic movement for St. Jude better. We are now in the process of rerouting the frontage road, Viking Drive, which was the former state frontage road, turned back to us. We're going to reroute that into another street, take it out of that critical 36 Rice Street interchange and try and make that function better. We're spending about $2 million on that project. We have received a state grant to help in that process, and that will be underway this year. So again, we're trying to do everything we can to facilitate this expansion in the community. I think it's also important to note that a year ago we also had to turn down the opportunity for a park and ride, a 400 car park and ride facility on the south side of the Rice Street 36 interchange, because that intersection is so poor. You know, we'd like to facilitate transit in that area, get people to and from work, get them to downtown St. Paul on a direct route. But because of the poor function of that intersection, we had to ask that be set aside because it would just exacerbate an already terrible situation.
Ms. Scalzi.
And if there's any questions, we do have representatives here from Ramsey County and MnDOT, or if you have any questions of Mr. Drews or Mr. Hansen or of me, we'd be happy to try to answer them.
And Representative Scalzi, I heard the year 2024. Is that correct? That's when the bridge would normally be.
That's what the schedule is, and if we follow the schedule, that's when it would be. But typically, the schedule kind of extends far off into the future, so it's kind of hard to say when it would be. But it's too far off for St. Jude Medical. There's no doubt about that.
Questions? Representative Dean.
Thank you. From the representative from St. Jude, where is the expansion supposed to be? Is it on the north side of 36 or on the south side of 36? And isn't that quite a ways?
Mr. Drews?
It would be on the north side, 36. We just recently completed the 100,000 expansion, square foot expansion on the south side.
Okay. And the only way to get to that facility is from that bridge, from, let's say, 35E?
35 Mr. and Drews. 36.
So the completion is done on the south side, and you're contemplating the one on the north side.
Correct.
And the bridge is the connection. Representative Tingleston?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just looking at this project and trying to recall if we've had any other bills in our committee that relate to road and bridge projects. I think this might be the first.
Well, I'm trying to recall what the Medtronic, what I compared this to by way of introduction was Representative Bernardi's bill for Medtronic, where suddenly the community felt the need to partner with the company in changes that were going to be made, and that's the one that that I think probably compares to this. Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Ms. Chair, and Representative Tingelstad. And we have been working with the Department of Employment and Economic Development as well, because this is a huge project for jobs in our state. And so we've been working with them and with representatives of the administration, and this is where they recommended that this project be looked at for funding.
And I Representative Tingelstad.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So Representative Scalzi, I'm wondering about the city and county commitment. I know in my district, you know, when there's a business or organization frustrated with the slowness, and we're not even on the schedule, at least you have a 2024, but the city and county fronts it, and so that's more money to our local property taxes. And certainly I support a gas tax increase to put more funding in all of this, but I'm wondering what kind of local commitment from your government organizations have you had?
Well,
thank
you, Ms. Chair and Representative Tingelstad. The county is currently looking at some other ways to mitigate some of the congestion in the area. And then, as you just heard from the city administrator of Little Canada, that's a $2 million project that that city is committed to easing the congestion in this area. And we're continuing on this process of making the a bad traffic situation better. And it's not going to get very much better, though, until we get that bridge widened. It's just there's four stoplights within a very short distance there. And if you've ever experienced that particular area north of the Capitol here, you can be caught in one stoplight when there's five cars ahead of you trying to get through the next stoplight, stopped for another car ahead of them. It's very, very difficult, and I've experienced it for a long time. And I just think that we're so fortunate to have a company like St. Jude in Minnesota. And we had a nice tour with Representative Mahoney's group at one of their other facilities. St. Jude Medical has properties worldwide, and they could expand their operations almost any place if they so choose. And I'm very pleased that they're interested in expanding their operations in Minnesota, and particularly north of the Capitol in my city. I think they're a wonderful tenant and wonderful community person, placeholder, and I think that it's just something that's important to the state.
And Representative Scalzi, my understanding was you did have an opportunity to meet at the governor's office on this project. Is that correct?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, we have worked with those. We've worked with Commissioner McElroy. We worked before that with Commissioner Assistant Commissioner Ward Innes, and we've had a working group working for well over a year on this project because it's something that's so important to the state.
And as they mentioned earlier, members, we, in one case, actually had to turn down Met Council funding for a park and ride because just given all the complexity of what we have just heard today, we felt that area was not ready for what the Met Council had planned at the time. Additional questions? If not, we thank you for bringing this issue before us, and it will be laid over.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
And Representative Erdahl, I thought we were going to get you up a little earlier, but our testifier came, so that's... This is Representative Erdahl's day in front of the committee, and he's joined by Reed Erickson, is that correct?
Oh, we switch.
Not Reed Erickson.
Dan Taylor.
Representative Erdahl moves House File 1257.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sorry, I've been running back and forth a little bit. We basically, our DNR folks got cornered across the hall here in the cafeteria with the Greenleaf folks, so they're having a spirited discussion.
Thanks for the update.
House File 1257 refers to the Greater Minnesota Business Development Public Infrastructure Grant Program. I've been practicing saying that. And this is a program that provides a very valuable service for the people of Minnesota and the cities. It's through deed. It's public infrastructure programs relating to business, dealing with water towers, industrial parks, and the infrastructure needs entailed there. As I understand it, in the last bonding bill, they ran out of money fairly quickly with this program. This $5 million is very beneficial to helping those cities that are on the list and needing this type of aid, and also will help us for the next bonding cycle, when I'm guessing that this fund will require more money. So with that, I have with me member of the Department of Employment and Economic Development, Mr. Dan Taylor.
Mr. Taylor, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. For the record, Dan Taylor, Department of Employment and Economic Development. I'm the manager for the business Greater Minnesota Business Infrastructure Grant Program.
Need a better name.
Sure. Yeah, we'll work on the shorter name for you. Again, as Mr. Representative Erdahl said, that the program was created in 2002. And it helps to provide monies for complex, costly public infrastructure grant programs around the state of Minnesota for greater Minnesota cities. The basic of the program is 3 points to keep or enhance jobs in a particular area, to increase city tax base, and to create or expand new economic development within a city. Applicants have been doing this for 3 years. We've funded 76 projects and in the process of creating 1,837 jobs and an average tax base increase of $3.6 million per project. The program has leveraged approximately $91.5 million to $24.7 million awarded. Although the projects have been very successful, we have the need is just greatly outweighs the resources available. That's why we're coming here today. We had 53 applications, for an example, this year, and we were able to fund 22, which left 32 projects unfunded. Thank you for your time, and if you have any questions.
Questions for the author. Representative Tinglestad.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the testifier, your last comment there about the number of applications and just about half of them or so were funded. What's the range of what you fund?
It can be anywhere from a couple hundred thousand to a million. It depends. This last year, because of the funding restrictions, we had to give priority to anybody that had 300,000 or less in their application.
Okay, thanks.
Representative Tinglestad, follow up? I believe there are no further questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Members, we're going to, I checked with Representative Tinglestad, and she is okay to add another item. It is a bill we heard, and at the time, we were still working on how I think the pages are going to, this is the Rural Finance Authority, and my understanding is there's been conversation with the governor's office, and Representative Junkie can explain that, but this, we heard it in committee. We laid it over, and Representative Junkie, if you would just speak to House File 274.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a bill we heard, if you remember, the RFA, and we are trying to fast forward it, and we still are. Time is short, needs are great, and folks are still waiting for these participation loans from the Rural Finance Authority and Department of Agriculture. Upon consultation with the governor's office over the last week or so, we have come up with a dollar value, and they have actually submitted it as a supplemental budget request. They originally requested $10 million. If you remember our original bonding request from the governor, they have increased that by $20 million to a total of $30 million, and they think that then will get us through at least till next July 1st. And in the interim, then, next year, we can review it, Madam Chair, see where we're at, how much of a need there was, and if we have to adjust in next year's bonding bill, we can. But again, we'd like to get this out and get it moving. There's a lot of people waiting. Bankers are calling, and we need this dollars moving forward. So, again, I do have Mr. Boerboom in the audience if there's any questions from the administration side of it. But if we could, Madam Chair, we need to amend this bill before we send it out to $30 million. It says $15 million, I believe, in two places. On line 1.22, Madam Chair, I'd move an amendment. Line 1.6, change of $15 million to $30 million. And on line 1.22, change of $15 to $30
million. And members, when the governor's supplemental bonding bill came out, this was one of the two items with that amount. And that is, and apparently they also now would like this to travel alone.
Right. And again, to remind members, this does not take a supermajority vote and does not go against our overall bonding debt. And the reason we found out they can use it, typically bonds are issued July 1st, so we thought there was no hurry, but they can use it right away. They actually, once the authority is given, they use general fund dollars and then pay it back with these dollars once they're issued on July 1st. So we can utilize it right away. And I think we have pretty good agreement on both sides of the aisle that this will travel out and hopefully over to the Senate, to the governor's desk fairly rapidly and not become a target as our omnibus bonding bill this year.
Representative Junkie moves an amendment to House File 274 on line 1-6. And line 122, change $15 million to $30 million. Any discussion to that amendment? Not all in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed? Motion carries.
Madam Chair, I'd renew my motion. House File 274 be recommended to pass and sent to the Committee on Finance. I believe it came down that way, so we have to go back up through Finance.
Representative Tinglestad.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Junkie. And so this is user financed. And so, Madam Chair, when we're looking at putting together our package for this committee, this won't count towards a limit. It's kind of a separate
right.
thing.
Madam Chair and Representative Tinkle said it's exactly right. It does not count towards our overall budget targets for bonding that we typically use. It is not counted by finance in that, what is it, 5% target?
3%.
Mm-hmm. 3%.
At a higher level, we were told at one point, at a higher level, it would perhaps affect that 2.5% of the personal income, but at this level, it has no effect on either of those percentages. Is there any further either questions or discussion about this issue? If not, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Motion carries, and House File number 274 is passed and referred to Finance, Committee on Finance. Members, Representative Junkie, if you would also move the minutes of March 8.
I would so move, Madam Chair.
Any discussion of those minutes? If not, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Motion carries and the minutes are approved. Members, if I had known that we would have moved so quickly through these, we would have added a couple more bills because we have room 500 North at 6:30 tonight, and if we move through those bills as quickly as we did these, hopefully we will not have you there long. We're going to adjourn this meeting, though, because it's in a new location, and they're going to pick up everything and redo the folders, and then we'll call a new meeting this evening. Yes, Representative Tinglestad?
Madam Chair, I just thought since we had a couple minutes, would it be possible to just sort of talk about what's coming next, with the timeline, what you see?
We, of course, all of this is tentative because we don't yet have our targets. But we are one of the bills. There might be several bills that move a little more quickly. Initially, we had set April 2nd as the time when all finance bills had to be out of their division, and bonding may move a little more rapidly than that, and so we may potentially be putting our bill together next week as early as Tuesday. We have tentatively scheduled a meeting for Monday in the event that happens, that on Monday we'd present the bill, people would have a chance to work on it overnight and take a look at it, and then we would take action on Tuesday. Again, this is a bit tentative, but we had to prepare for the possibility that we might be fast-tracking this particular bill. Representative Tinglestad.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So just a kind of a question to that, because I know some of the bills that we're hearing are for next year, and I think the ones that are for this year have been pretty specific about that.
Yeah.
So anything that we've heard then this year, how will that work as far as putting the bonding bill together next year?
Well, in a biennial schedule, nothing really dies the first year. Everything stays on the table where it is, and so we wouldn't need to rehear. It's the same committee. We wouldn't need to rehear bills. There are even some bills that we still have coming up that have been heard. I think one of them in Representative Leaders Committee and a couple in Education that we might have on Friday. So if it's heard in another committee, we usually don't repeat that hearing either. Was that?
I guess I'm confused by your last statement then. So if another committee is hearing it and it's referred to our committee, so we're not going to hear it then?
My understanding is, I'm looking to Jenny Nash if that's not correct, K-12 Finance has heard a few bonding bills this year, two, I think. And since they've heard them, we can just receive a recommendation from that committee, and we don't need to hear them again, but we would still reference it and get a discussion from Representative Greiling, should that.
We do have the individual bills before us, but we will.
We actually have them in committee.
Okay. So. Good. Thank you.
So, again, this is tentative, but it kind of puts us on alert, and what it means is I'll probably be having lots of conversations individually with you in the next few days, and either I'll seek you out or you seek me out. I know people have worked very hard and have thoughtfully listened, and so to get feedback from you now on shaping that bill will be important. So if there is no further discussion, meeting is adjourned. We will come to order. We are assuming that members will be here momentarily. I just came from Transportation Finance, and I know Representative Leader is still there, as is our fiscal analyst and our CFL researcher, so we're overlapping committees a little bit. But we'll begin with Rick Jonas from the Department of Transportation. And what we're interested in is just a bit of a an idea of local bridge needs. Very often in our bonding bills, we try to look at local bridge needs and try to do what we can. So if you can give us some information about that, that would be helpful.
Certainly, Madam Chair. My name is Rick Jonas. I am Deputy State Aid Engineer for MnDOT. And I was talk to you briefly about last year's bonding bill in relation to bridges. There was $55 million appropriated. And that money was quickly spent. We received that money and got authorization to start passing it out to counties and cities and townships in May, and by the end of June we had made all of the awards. With that money, there was 199 bridges that received funding from that program, That is not the only source of funding that goes towards bridges. There's other sources. In the actual construction work done last year, 205 bridges were replaced on local roads, and $34 million of the bridge funding money was actually spent and given to contractors. The other bridges that receive bridge bonding money are awaiting construction this spring. The money is under contract, but the work didn't get started last fall. Locals have been developing their continuing list. They have an annual program. They have 714 bridges that they have on a list that they feel could be constructed this year. And they have turned into our office between 30 and 35 plans. I don't know the exact count as of today. They're coming in on a daily basis of projects that could actually be advertised for bids tomorrow if money was available. In the packets, there was three maps that summarized some of the information that I just talked about. The first small map is the 714 bridges, showing how they're distributed throughout the state by county. And the next page is the same information showing the 714 bridges that could be constructed this year by House District. And the last page is the 205 bridges that were replaced last year using portions of the bridge bonding money made available. So all in all, a successful summer and much appreciated, much work left to do.
And Mr. Jonas, if you have, I didn't take notes, if you have those numbers on paper, if we could have that for our files so that when we take a look at this, do you have printed material that you...
I could send you something.
That would be just fine.
Yeah.
And then what I seem to recall a number of years ago when Representative Knobloch was chair, that when we had the bonding bill before us, he actually distributed to individual members, these are bridges in your district. Is that, can you give that kind of specificity, or are you giving kind of general information here that really one can't apply?
The 714 bridges, Madam Chair, is that what you're asking about? Do we know exactly where they are? Yes, we do. They are our county and city council resolutions that create that list, and we do actually have a computer-generated list showing the exact bridge and the estimated costs.
And would it go, let's just say, for example, we do $10 million, it would go down the list this far, or we do 20 or 30? Could we make those sorts of judgments based on...
Madam Chair, no. That is not normally how we would work this, especially with such an enormous number of bridges, 714 bridges. We typically fund bridges as they come in ready for construction on a first-come, first-served basis. So today we have 30 to 35 bridges, and we would look at the mix of funds that they brought to the table and then provide matching bridge bonding funds if we had bridge bonding funds, and that's how that program has been working.
Okay. We thought that was the case, but we thought we'd just clarify just to determine. Any questions? Mr. Jones. Okay. Representative Tingelstad.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Jones, so I have a question then. You said there's 35 plans turned in and that you would look through those. So, and how much money they bring to the table. What does it take to turn in a plan? So if my county was interested, what would they need to do?
These 35 plans have gone through all the environmental review. They have turned in their plans to the MnDOT Bridge office and had their structural designs checked and verified. And they are, the specifications are, everything is ready to go, that an advertisement for bids could be posted tomorrow. They're that far along. The remainder of the 714 bridges are in various stages, and they're coming into our office at an approximate rate of 1 to 2 per day as they get processed through the bridge office.
Follow up, Ms.
Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, and you said last year, basically in about a month, month and a half, $54 million, $55 million was spent, and so. With 35 plans turned in, I realize that there's big variation there, but it could be spent fairly quickly. Is that safe to say?
Madam Chair, Representative, last year, with the money becoming available to us in May, we had enough plans on our desk when the money became available that it was just as matter as fast as we could process the paper. At this time, with the 30 to 35 bridges, I don't know what the estimated cost of those bridges are, but they're running on the neighborhood of $300,000 per bridge typically.
Mm-hmm.
One more follow-up. Thank you, Madam Chair. Just curious, so a $300,000 bridge, how many jobs is that? Any idea?
Yes. Mr. Jones.
Madam Chair, Representative, if you're wondering how many jobs, how many people are employed out on the job site to build a bridge, that could vary based on the bridge.
Okay.
And of course, there's other jobs too with fabrication and survey work and engineering work before and after construction. I would not like to venture a guess.
Okay, thank you. Appreciate it.
Any other questions? If not, thank you. That gives us the information we need. And Representative Tingelstad, we're going to move your bill now because I think you're the only author in the room right this minute. And Representative Abler is going to join you. And Representative Tingelstad moves House File 1308 for consideration. And Representative Tingelstad also moves Is this all right? House File 1263 to get both bills before us?
Madam Chair, I think we have to run it by, don't we?
Well, they are all just laid aside for consideration.
My bill's better. They're both really good bills.
And you may be joined at the table by whoever you'd like to.
Chair.
How are you doing? Our good sheriff is here.
Representative Tingelstad, are you going first?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. And Paige has packets coming around. And I forgot to grab my newspaper article from yesterday, but in the Star Tribune there was an article about the need for forensics labs and the backlog of DNA issues around the state. Actually, is this it here? Yes. Well, this is an earlier one. There's various things in your packet. And with me today here, I thought I was going to have Captain Aldrich, but I've got even better, Sheriff Bruce Anderson. But I want to kind of highlight from this one-page sheet that's in your left-hand pocket here of your folder, and I think this gives a good overview of House File 1308, and it's a regional crime lab, and it would be part of the Anoka County Public Safety Facility, and the sheriff will tell you more about that in a few minutes. What I found out, what I learned about this project was that it's really a unique one in that it's a first of its kind combining state, county, and private educational partners. And as you can see there, it's the three counties plus Hamline University and the State Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. But even more important, with the backlog of forensic analysis information, there is really a need statewide to have this additional forensics lab because it would really free up things around the state. Under capabilities there, it says it has a potential to service the 1 million population within 40 miles, which would really help the whole state backlog. And then this is a $6 million crime lab as a part of the $25 million total safety facility. And so what's nice about it, too, is the matching dollars with it. So the $6 million state bonding would be matched with $19 million in county funding, which is a nice 1-to-3 ratio, and I know we're always looking for those in our committee. But, you know, one of the important things about this, shown in the benefits there towards the end, is just the cost savings. And I'm sure the officers here will tell you in a few minutes about the extra costs to the county and the state in the delays with lab work, and that really about $7,600 in extra housing costs for inmate plus medical costs and delayed trials and additional law enforcement costs associated with incarceration. And so I think there's really a need for this as soon as possible. It would help statewide, and I think with that, I'd like to turn it over to the testifiers.
Representative Tingelstad, I didn't realize this was a local bill for me. What's the role of Hamline University?
Sheriff will tell us as a partner educational.
Three sheriffs.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Bruce Anderson. I'm the sheriff in Anoka County. The bill request you have before you, as far as Representative Tingelstad mentioned, for $6 million to assist with the construction and startup of the regional forensic lab serving the counties of Wright, Sherman, and Anoka. Now, I want to begin by saying this is not an indictment of the current VCA. We have a good working relationship with the VCA. We support their initiatives, but we recognize the fact that the system in Minnesota is the demand for services far outweighs the capacity of the existing system. We have a single source of service provided by the VCA. There are 87 sheriff's offices, 450-some odd police departments, and we just believe that the increased use of forensic science in the criminal justice system really necessitates a change in the way we do business in the state of Minnesota. We all are well aware of the evidence backlogs at the BCA and the amount of time it takes to get evidence back processed from that facility. Some of that evidence backlog can take months to get to us. During the course of that time, there are significant costs to taxpayers. Representative Tingelstad mentioned the cost of incarceration. There are costs to having someone in jail when they haven't been charged. not guilty of a crime, there's a cost there, although it's a human cost. If they stay in jail while waiting to charge them, there are costs to the counties. If they're released on bond or out RPR, they have the potential to commit additional crimes and victimize additional citizens in the state of Minnesota, and we see that as a significant public safety issue. We also would suggest to you that currently the system, as backlogged as it is, does not do justice to many of the crimes that are committed in the state of Minnesota that could prevent crimes down the road. We know from studies by the National Institute of Justice that using things like DNA to process even property crimes has a significant impact on more serious crimes such as homicide and sexual assault. Recent studies show that in New York, of 1,000 DNA hits on homicide and sexual assault, fully 82% had been arrested prior on burglary or drug charges. And those are crimes we often overlook in the use of DNA and other physical evidence simply because of the capacity of the BCA to deal with those issues for us. So we in Minnesota have in some respects been a bit behind the curve in that we are not submitting probably all the evidence that would be serving the best interest of the public and public safety in Minnesota. You asked about the relationship between the three counties and Hamline University. Early on in the discussions between the sheriffs, we talked about the potential to have a teaching institution attached to this facility so that we could train the next generation or future generations of forensic scientists in the business. Hamline has a very popular program. It's one of the few in the state, and we began to partner with them to provide internships up in Anoka with Hamline University. We have been doing that for about 5 years. This would expand that. It also would create opportunities for long-distance teaching through video conferencing and other things through the staff at Hamline. So we're excited about the partnership. We believe it may be a unique partnership in the nation, perhaps, between ELAB, which is designed as a regional facility, and a private teaching institution. I can turn the mic over to some of my colleagues if they have things they'd like to add here, but we do believe this would better serve the interests of public safety in Minnesota on a statewide basis. The reality is that we collect a great deal of evidence that's not submitted to the BCA. If we began to submit all evidence, we certainly would increase the backlog. I know the BCA has a current request for additional scientists, and we support that, but we do not feel that that is a proper way of doing business in the state of Minnesota. We wouldn't have one hospital to serve the state. We wouldn't have one university to serve the state. So to have a single crime lab doesn't make good public policy sense to us. And with that, I'll turn it over to my colleagues.
Representative Abler, I would maybe just give Representative Abler an opportunity to say a word.
Well, no point to be too redundant.
Talk about the better bill.
they're both really nice, actually. Mine's a little shorter, I think. But they, and how, if as you go forward to this, you can pick the version you like, and they're both dandy. We'll be happy with either one. But there's a piece in your packet showing that the regional piece, and I would imagine as this goes forward that there'll be this will become even bigger than just the three counties. And I know one of the standards we have is it's going to have an impact beyond a certain small locale. And these are three very rapidly growing counties, Madam Chair. And as they reach out even to the other counties that need other help, I imagine that they'll be serving more. So I think you want to hear from the sheriffs.
Members, you may have, there was a newspaper article, as I recall, or someplace along the way about the number of Bruce Andersons we have around here. And tonight we have sitting before us actually two of those Bruce Andersons.
Madam Chair? No offense to Representative Abler, but the only thing that would have made this bill better is if Representative Bruce Anderson had the bill.
Do you want to hear from more sheriffs then?
Well, let's see if we have it. Representative Mahoney has a question.
Well, I guess my question is I'm wondering if public safety is in the audience here, and actually I have a question for them. So if the sheriffs have any more testimony, I'm very comfortable listening to that and then talking with public safety.
Is public safety?
Yeah. Do I
see anybody?
Well,
Representative Mahoney.
We can. My comments can come at the end of the testimony. It's not a problem.
Okay. We're not inviting more, but if you have more information.
No, please. I'm just going to point out that I'm the only non-Anderson sheriff in the room. I'm Gary Keller from Brant County. And I would add that, you know, we're looking for help with the bricks and mortar, and the counties have come together here to support the ongoing operational costs. Our commissioners recognize the need, and I think our constituents have a greater expectation for evidence processing and the speed of the results of that than we've experienced in the past. We've quite a few years of law enforcement experience sitting here at the table today, and we recognize the need to change the way we do business. Thank you.
And I didn't see anyone stand when we asked, is there anyone from public safety in the room? So,
or the state, or BCA.
Or BCA. So, apparently not. So,
Madam Chair, and it's for the testifiers and for the committee, the BCA is in my district. I fought tooth and nail and a little bit more and to get the extra lab space there. And the last time I toured it, they had extra room there. So I'm kind of perplexed why we're coming down. You know, we got another lab up in Bemidji. I mean, if you need it, that's fine. I'm not trying to say we shouldn't put criminals behind bars. But I thought they built that building to be able to service the state for 20 or 25 years. And I know Senator Kelly, I actually was in the room when he was having conversations about that. It's always a joy to watch Randy go after something that he wanted. And I thought, before we vote on this, I'd like to hear from public safety and the BCA and where their problem is. So
we'll
get them here.
We'll make that request. And I happen to know, because I, of course, raised the same question with them when they were in my office. So I happen to know they might also want to respond.
Well, Madam Chair, members of the committee, we understand that the BCA has the ability to increase their capacity. We still don't feel that's going to be enough. You're seeing the hue and cry from Minneapolis, from St. Paul, from Hennepin County, from across the state. If you add 10, 20 scientists, whatever the governor's proposal is over time, we don't think that's sufficient. We don't think that a single source provider in the state of Minnesota makes good public policy sense. There are any host of reasons why, you know, that that would be a bad idea, but we can tell you that the system right now is already over capacity. We're already demanding more service than they're capable of delivering. So even if we add, we aren't going to catch up. We're not going to catch up because, as they saw up in Bemidji, they added 12 scientists up there when the city of Bemidji built the facility and they staffed it, and the number of cases and the caseload increased substantially. The same will happen here. There are many cases right now that we are not submitting to the BCA for a number of reasons. They've asked us not to. We self-impose kind of limits, realizing the backlog is significant and they can't catch up. So those limitations won't go away by just adding scientists to the BCA. We need to look at other ways of doing business and having some local input on that. I personally, as a sheriff, would like to see us go to submitting things like DNA and other evidence on all crimes, including property crimes, because of the information from the National Institute of Justice and research projects in Dade and Palm Springs and New York City, where they realize that the greatest impact they can have on violent crime is to impact property crimes early on, because property crime offenders become the offenders who commit those other crimes. We have cases that languish unsolved for months. There was the Maple Grove homicide, where a burglar was responsible for the death of an elderly woman in her home. We had a homicide in Anoka County where burglars were responsible, who had been prolific burglars across the state of Minnesota. Had we utilized more of the forensic sciences along the way, not necessarily us as individuals, but as a profession, perhaps those cases could have been prevented. And so if we all, the 450 police departments and the 87 sheriff's offices, began to flood the BCA with the type of evidence that we think we should be processing, I guarantee you wouldn't be able to keep pace.
And I seem to recall that you indicated that, in fact, BCA is requesting additional staff, and you are, in fact, supportive of that.
We are.
Because you believe that.
Because we feel it serves the needs of the citizens of Minnesota, but we also feel it's time for us to do business in a different manner.
Representative,
Madam Chair, and in today's paper, I think it was, or yesterday, is the whole page of sex offenders who are missing. And, you know, that's important to all of us, just as a piece. But I know there's a backlog. How long is the backlog of what you're, I mean, on a normal request?
It depends on the case, and it depends on the type of case. You know, there are times they expedite, but I can tell you on the average, we're seeing backlogs. I looked at the statistics earlier today, and I know that such as DNA might be 2.5 months before that's processed. But again, we're not submitting all those DNA cases that we probably should be. Drug testing may take between 2 and 3 months. We have cases, drug offenses, that go out 6 months. There are times when we actually lose cases or have them dismissed by prosecutors in courts because of the delay between the time that someone is arrested and the speedy trial requirement because of a failure to have that drug evidence processed and returned back to the counties. The counties are making this move on their own. You know, over time we've seen Hennepin County establish a DNA lab. I think St. Paul has a drug chemistry lab. They're in the process of kind of looking for some federal funds to do DNA. Obviously, there's an issue here that we think is addressed by a regional approach. We don't think that it is unreasonable to think that maybe regional facilities that support and complement what the BCA does, because we'll never get away from using the BCA completely. Quite honestly, there are specialties that they have that we may never develop. We may not develop a document section that goes in and does examination of handwriting samples just because of the demand or our need for that service. But there are other areas like drug testing and like DNA and like fingerprinting that we really need to have the capacity to do that and increase the amount and the volume that the state can handle. So.
Well, Madam Chair and Sheriff Anderson, you make a good argument for it, but I hope you'll understand if I insist that we talk to the BCA and find out two things. Why there's the backlog, and they can come up with whatever reason they want, and why they told us it would serve the state for 20 or 25 years, and it's just 4 or 5 years later. And, you know, our police officers are very honest people. Maybe it must have been the bureaucrats.
Well, I don't necessarily want to lay blame anywhere. I think
Well,
the reality is that I think we've seen an expectation that's changed in those 4 or 5 years. It's been driven by some people refer to it as the CSI effect, but we're seeing juries and prosecutors and judges and court systems and citizens really demanding a greater accountability with regard to forensic sciences. And I think that perhaps is what's driving that.
No, that was my comment. A greater expectation, and the citizens are expecting a timely answer to the evidence that we
brought. Would you
please
identify yourself for the record again?
I am Sheriff Gary Miller from Wright County. We have done mutual training, and Anoka County's helped train our crime scene processing individuals. So we go out and do a very professional job of processing crime scenes on property crimes, stolen autos. But then that evidence has to be processed. And quite frankly, the citizen expects an answer. You know, what did you find out from the forensic evidence at my crime? And 2 months later, if they're asking the same question, it's a perception that law enforcement in this state or in our county isn't up with the times, I guess, is quite frankly. And then there's a delay in prosecution. Also, you can have a plea. If you have hard forensic evidence and your suspect's identified in a timely manner, the prosecutor has more tools in their toolkit when they go in to talk to the defense attorney as to a plea agreement to that crime. So we think that this, it's changed. It's changed in our perception in the last 10 years and probably more so in the last 5 years, what's expected of us as the chief law enforcement officers in our jurisdiction. So thank you.
Thank you. Any concluding comments?
Madam Chair and members, I appreciate the opportunity to present this tonight, and I know budgets are going to be tight here, but you know, based on this need and the backlog and what it could do regionally and across our state, I think this is a really good project, and I urge your support. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Saylor. I will move House File 1673. Representative Saylor. And if your testifiers would come to the table. Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
We appreciate this opportunity to present this bill before this, the Capital Bonding Committee. And basically, the bill is the same that we had presented in the past, although I know a number of the members of the committee
many,
changed.
Many new members.
So we are, you know, kind of starting from the beginning. The Northern Emergency Training Administration Center has been devised out of a need in northwestern Minnesota to provide a better opportunity for training for emergency personnel, law enforcement, and fire departments in that area. One of the problems we have up in the northwest part of the state is long distances that preclude people from getting to various training opportunities without leaving town. And naturally, we prefer to keep our emergency folks close to the towns that they're serving. So that is one of the reasons behind this. I'll just be very brief, and then I will leave it to the testifiers, just to say that this the purpose is training first responders of all types, and it'll be an opportunity for providing instruction for prevention, intervention, response, mitigation, and recovery for natural disasters, terroristic acts, and this purpose is to encourage and stimulate and maintain excellence in emergency first responders of all sorts up in northwestern Minnesota. I believe you have packets before you, and as I said, in an effort to be brief, I will have the Mayor Tom Stenzel giving further testimony. I'll just say that at this time, the bill is asking for $50,000, which is just money for a startup, which seems like a very reasonable thing to do in a year when we're just looking at a more limited capital bonding budget this year. This would allow for pre-design for the Emergency Training Administration Center, so it would be very timely to have that opportunity and that money awarded to the Donwick Center at this time. But I will now leave this to the Mayor, Tom Stenzel.
And Representative Saylor, just paging through here, there are many, 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 many local governments. Do you have a count of how many have weighed in on this?
Madam Chair, I believe it's 26.
26.
At least. And this one other thing I should say, this information, you'll see that there's some 06, you know, the data in here. Rather than print up entirely new brochures and all of this information simply to change to the 07, you'll see that date is the same. But in the back of the book, past the second red divider, are indeed the letters of support from the many local entities, counties, cities, and townships.
And do we have Stacy Halverson and Tom Stenzel?
Yes, we do.
Okay, and Stacy Halverson, the city clerk. Welcome to the committee.
Hi, thank you. Tom, I think you were going to touch base on this a little bit.
Sure. We're going to start with Tom Stenzel.
Yeah.
Okay. Tom Stenzel, welcome to the committee. Mayor of the City of Donwick.
Yep. Thank you, Madam Chair. Committee members, again, just refresh the letters of support in the back. I believe we have 53 different letters of support from local communities, sheriff's departments, local counties in the northern 26 tier states. And it was a good response to that, and also some local utility companies, Enbridge Oil and Otter Tail Electric and other local utilities also. I guess just to briefly go through, for the ones who aren't familiar with what we're proposing here, it's a training facility with five major components. Hazardous material training for any kind of hazardous materials, spills, or response to that. We've trained for that. Law enforcement training, we have live fire ranges, shooting ranges for training, also mock simulations on different scenarios that they would come up with in the field, whether it be search and rescue or tactical maneuvering. Also fire department training, which would encompass live burn tower, live burn simulations, smoke simulations for search and rescue, and repelling. Ventilation procedures, you know, fire truck, just down to simple things, is just operating fire trucks, how to make volunteer fire departments. You know, we're in an area where it's all volunteer fire departments based up in northern Minnesota. So you're looking at most departments having 20 volunteer fire department members that are, you know, doing this 360 days a year. But the problem is we don't have, you know, we don't get 100 calls a day like maybe they do in the cities. We get 100 to 150 calls a year. So this would give us the familiarity of working with their equipment and the training we need to help keep us fresh in responding to these calls. Also, EMS training for any kind of mass casualty situations, whether it be a school situation or any other type of terroristic threat situation. It would help train EMS in dealing with the mass casualty situation in our hospitals and most fire departments up there are first responders. So it would give us a chance to help us familiarize ourselves with any type of that training and just basic first responding skills. You know, we cover, as far as the Gowanus Fire Department, we cover 7 townships, 150 square miles. And we're usually the first ones on the scene to help render first aid to any of our people in our area before the local ambulance or hospital can get there. So this is a chance for the departments to come and use that facility to train for that type of situation so they know what to do for this, being the first on the scene. Also, communication is going to be a key component. You know, whenever there's a situation at a school or a severe, even a threat or something that arises, communication is a key component that sometimes is lacking, in northern Minnesota. There's always, the cell phones don't always work properly. Radios don't always work properly.
Some of us have experienced that.
This is something that is part of the component that we can utilize to be able to shore up that communication. So there's backup communication, so everyone can communicate with each other, so everyone knows what's going on, how to respond properly, and do the things they need to do, the correct situation that's at hand. Again, you can see, the synopsis here gives you kind of the budget we're looking on. It'd be self-sustaining. What we're looking for is this pre-designed design money so we can shore up the design that we're looking at and help us, get specific on exactly what we're looking at to provide. Obviously, it's a cooperation between the city of Gondik and the local fire department who's working to get this thing going. And, you can see the City Gondik's donation. We're looking at donating some city lots here that's, around 4% of our city budget. It's going to be self-sufficient, and we're also looking at other funds federally, about $2.3 million federally to get some funds. So what we're trying to find here is just something to get us going and get us some design money so we can get a proper design and get this thing rolling.
Representative Carlson has a question.
Yeah, if the testimony is done. I was just curious, who does the training? I'm familiar with at least one of the training centers down here in the cities that's tied into the Minsky system and Tech College system. And so once the facility is complete, who actually instructs the people? Are they tied in with Minsky or?
Go ahead. If this is the fire chief here from Gondik, and he can probably address that if that's all right, as far as exactly who's going to be coordinating that.
Madam Chair, and Dan
please,
Johnson.
Dan Johnson.
Dan Johnson, fire chief.
Yes, we're looking at different venues after it's completed on getting Minsky involved. We've gotten some good response from them willing to come to our facility and teach for us. And then, as Zach goes on, then we'll get some guys of our own, maybe an area that can get qualification and teach also.
Okay, thank you.
Any further testimony? Representative Tinglestad has.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm looking at the budget here, and I understand with this bill you're looking for a $50,000 appropriation to kind of get you started for the pre-design. Total project is $4.2 million, and it looks like you'd be back then, what, next year for $2 million in Minnesota state bonding dollars? Is that correct?
That would be correct.
That is Mr. Stenzel.
Yes. Oh, sorry about that, Madam Chair. Yes, that would be correct. We'd be back to look for like I said, it's about a $4.2 million total project cost. We'd be looking for trying to get close to half from the state and the rest from the federal.
So to follow up, Madam Chair, Mr. Stenzel, so then potentially $2.3 million from the feds, what's the chance on that? What's the timing? Tell me a little about that.
I guess we have had some leads through that. As far as timing, you know, we go to the federal government, and they're kind of, you know, try to get some funds from the state, and the state's getting funds from the federal. So I guess we're kind of in between here. So we're starting here with the state to try to get some design money so we can shore up the design, make it, go where we want it to go, and then hopefully with that design we can take that and run both state and federal at the same time. We kind of had a timeline here. Obviously the dates are, me and we were here last year at the bonding year, it's the years are a year off. And so, I mean, you'd have to jump everything here a little bit. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of, you know, our timeline and what we were expecting. It's a, you know, pretty aggressive timeline, but I think it's something we can achieve.
Okay, just one further question, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Stenzel. So I'm trying to see if I'm reading your fact sheet here correctly. It looks like you've got projected annual expenditure, projected annual revenue. Okay, revenue about $423,000, expenditure $266,000. So where does the difference go?
I got to see where exactly.
Mr. Stenzel, you're looking at the one.
Yeah, it's the data. Right under project data, and then it kind of lists off. So it's got expenditure revenue. Madam Chair.
If you turn to your second divider.
Okay.
And that is Stacey Alberson.
Yep.
On the city clerk. I'm just doing that for the record.
You can take a look at the expenses on the first page and the revenue on the second.
Okay.
As of 06, our annual operating cost was $259,108. And June of each year following, we factored in an additional 3% for the inflation multiplier.
Wait a minute, ma'am. Do we really, do we add inflation in around here?
Inside joke.
We don't do that.
And then on the revenue, you can turn the page and each membership cost is $150. We calculated 450 memberships with 15 components. First column, this is the charge per group session. Nine sessions for each component a month. This brings the total revenue for the year to $411,375. And then we calculated each year for in the inflation.
Oh, okay.
The annual operating income was $152,267.
So, Madam Chair,
Representative,
thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know if I'm missing something. So it looks like there's a profit projected on it each year, and I'm just wondering, does that pay for salaries or some extra operating costs, or who gets the windfall?
Probably.
Yeah, it'll partially pay salaries, whatever money that we have to borrow.
Okay.
We'll pay back.
Does that clarify, or do you need more? I mean, because we could.
I'm assuming it's a break-even operation, so maybe if your numbers in the next chart could show that. Yeah. Thank you.
Any further questions? If not, we thank you very much for the bill presentation and the. And the education about the need.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Beers.
Sure. Madam Chair, I'd like to move that House File 502 be brought before us for consideration.
Representative Beard, welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members, thank you. It's good to be here. There is a brief handout, yes, we have regarding our Activities at Scale, one of the organizations I'm very proud to represent here at the Capitol.
Was that an acronym?
It is. Scott County Association for Leadership and Efficiency. In Scott County, we have every township, school district, and city that gets together once a month for coffee and donuts. It's a good thing. I participate, as you can tell. But it's good because we just sit around and talk about stuff. And everybody's connected with everyone else, and they know what's going on in the townships and the school districts. It's a pretty marvelous invention or example of collaboration in that we actually share equipment, have several joint powers agreements between ourselves. We do things as practical as site fire stations so that our districts don't overlap or leave large holes in coverage, things like that. So several years ago, when several fire departments were talking about public safety training and the difficulty they were having buying time in the burning tower at in Bloomington or in our neck of the woods because we have so many old homes and we're growing like crazy, there is an inventory of old houses to burn down, but we're even running out of those. Besides, it's kind of hard to get permits from MPCA to continue to burn down houses, although it's great fun to crawl through there with fire gear on. If you ever get a chance, please do it. But we need to, I digress, Madam Chair. We need to have a regional training center where we can actually train our fire departments, our police departments, finding shooting times on shooting ranges sometime before the hour, after the hour, 6 a.m. and before midnight is getting very difficult. So we talked about building our own facility for Scott County, but you know, in the spirit of scale, the collaboration, cooperation, and just generally neighborliness that goes on down there, we thought, why don't we reach out to other counties around us, because they're probably in the same boat we're in. So that led to the creation of the Scott County Joint Regional Training Facility that many of you on this committee actually have seen. Remember, we had the bus tour. Both the Senate and House bonding committees have come down there within the last 2 years to see the place. Last year, this committee was so good as to grant us $1 million of the $4.2 million request. The county, of course, has put up a considerable amount of money, the county and the partners within the scale organization. And there actually is great progress to report. So, Madam Chair, I'm here to invite this committee to come down again this summer or next, your call, and we'd be happy to show you the progress we've made with the shooting range and, I believe, the preliminary construction on the first burn tower, because there'll be several different types of fire training towers that will be there for several different types of fires. We're asking this year again for $3.2 million, which will complete the state's portion, as we proposed it to you, of this regional training facility. It's a facility that covers several counties and city jurisdictions in the southern metro area, reaching from the Mississippi River almost all the way to Mankato. I believe we are the regional training facility that Representative Carlson referred to a moment ago when he talked about active cooperation from MinSCU, because some of the training courses that are being designed for public safety people and administration, this isn't just about training firefighters and police officers, this is about training public safety people on how to handle emergencies that may happen, and the city and county administrations that have to handle and administer plans that may involve pandemics or mass evacuations, so on and so forth. But I did bring somebody much more expert at this to speak to me. In fact, I brought two witnesses tonight, Madam Chair and members. I brought Commissioner John Rolrig from the Scott County Board to say a few words, and then I brought Assistant Administrator, Deputy Administrator Gary Shelton, who's been the point person on this project and has all the answers for you. So if I may first introduce Commissioner Rolrig.
Commissioner Rolrig, yes, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you, and it's a pleasure to be here, an honor. And I'm here representing SCALE, Scott County Association for Leadership and Efficiency, and the Regional Training Facility. And I guess Representative Beard had outlined quite a number of the features of the training facility. I want to highlight just really two key points. One is that it is a very comprehensive training center in terms of for law enforcement, for fire prevention, for public works, for public health, and then hazardous materials professionals. And we also have a potential for a rail derailment training, where I think the closest other of that type of possibility would be in New Mexico. And so this is probably the most comprehensive training center facility in the state. It also has the potential for sleeping over. The building is our old jail annex. It was a historic building. It's been many things. At one time, it was a a mud bath, but it's a beautiful facility for having all types of training, canine as well, but sleeping over. So the word comprehensive is one of the key words. And then also regional. It's totally a regional, probably statewide facility. Public safety person that's either visited or heard of this concept has been very enthusiastic about it. We've got a long list of partners that have already signed on to use the facility, like the Burnsville Police and Fire, Carver County Sheriff's Office and Fire Association, Chaska Police and Fire, Egan Police, Hamburg Police, Lakeville Police, the Seward County Sheriff's Office, Nicola County Sheriff's Office, St. Bonifacius Fire, Sibley County Sheriff's Office, South Central College, and the St. Paul Police. All these partners have indicated they're going to use the facility and they're excited about it. The list of supporters and those that want to use it is growing. And we received $1 million. You might say the state is also a supporter because we did receive $1 million last year in the bond. And we're requesting another. We had requested 4.2 last year. We got the first $1 million to get us going. And we need the additional 3.2 to really flesh out and finish this comprehensive facility and the final design. And we all know this is an era where public safety training is critical, and we believe that this is a great answer to the state's needs.
And Representative Carlson, would your question to the previous project be relevant to this one also?
Madam Chair, it was touched on in the testimony that they also would be cooperating with the fire already.
Any questions? Representative Mustad?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Beard, the bill before you talked about some possibilities with maybe Homeland Security dollars or some kind of federal dollars. I don't know. Can you talk about maybe with your testifiers possibilities with federal funding on this?
Madam Chair, we will. I'd like to introduce the gentleman who can do just that, address that question, would be our Assistant County Administrator, Gary Shelton.
Mr. Shelton.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Representative Beard asked if I could update you on the progress that we've made since we were here last year talking about this particular facility. And I'm happy to report that I think we've made some great progress in moving this project forward. Using the $1 million seed money that was approved in the bonding bill last year, we have been able to actually formalize and have the governing jurisdictions in all of the 8 cities in Scott County and the county itself develop a joint powers agreement and agree to a funding formula and also agree to a participation in funding not just the capital piece of this but also in the operational piece of it. We've put together a projected budget for 2007 and 2008. The facility is already being used because there were a variety of structures that are there. So in terms of some of the classroom training and even some tactical training in some areas of the building, that training is currently taking place. But in putting together that joint powers agreement, we needed to make sure that we had secured both the capital dollars and operating dollars to complete at least the first phase. Originally, we had intended to have the county donate the land and the site, in addition to which having the local jurisdictions put together $4.2 million to match the state's $4.2 million. I'm happy to report that the local jurisdictions have agreed to up their contribution in their resolutions to $5 million, and in large part because as we have put together and brought an architect on board, we've retained an architect, we've gone through the schematic and the we're at kind of the pre-construction documents phase of this particular project and have a hearing in April before the county's Planning and Zoning Commission for our conditional use permit. Part of what we realized is that where we had originally talked about putting together a 15-point shooting position range at 200 yards, that there were components as we were working with various providers, various public service agencies that said, we really need what's referred to as both a tactical component. By that I mean a range that rather than shooting from fixed positions at fixed targets that would allow them to do 270 degrees of shooting, so shooting in a variety of different directions at moving targets and also while the officers themselves are moving. And so in our design, we've done a couple of things. Pull the range back, the 200-yard range, and split it to where we're actually constructing a couple of ranges as opposed to a single range. which actually necessitated about $800,000 more in funding, which the local governments that are participating agreed to provide in their bonding. The county will actually be issuing the bond. The board has, so we have it in our capital plan. The board has approved us to move forward with that process. So the county has agreed to issue the $5 million in bond to cover all of the local participation with reimbursement coming from the eight cities and also the Midwakaton Sioux community. The Midwakaton community has passed a memorandum of understanding and agreement. They couldn't participate because they're not included in the statute in a joint powers agreement, but did feel that they could participate under a memorandum of understanding and agreement. That has been approved by the tribe. It's also been approved by the county board and the city jurisdictions. And Carver County's board is currently working on, and we're working with them on a joint powers agreement there. They made a request to join as part of the funding for this particular facility, and we are moving in that direction. That should be, we hope, approved by the end of April. In addition to which, we have fully engaged the South Central College and also the Minnesota State University at Mankato. South Central has been to the scale group. They have put forward a proposition after looking at what the facility will do to provide collective OSHA training. One of the focuses of this facility was to find a way to provide training to everybody that participates. So this would be for the school districts, the cities, the counties, in all of their OSHA training, and rather than having South Central come out and do training for Belle Plaine, training for Shakopee, training for whoever, they will come out and put on two or three classes each month at the facility that will be participated in by all of the various entities, and so that is moving forward relatively quickly. In addition to which, we have been engaged with the Minnesota State University at Mankato. They have a law enforcement program that they are quite interested in looking at this facility. We've had a couple of discussions with them about they have space needs, particularly needs when it comes to their lab and what they're able to do with the field component and lab type of work for their law enforcement program. And so they're interested in trying to see if they can move that component from the State University in Mankato actually out to this site, and we have a meeting on April 4th with them where all of their extended, the Dean of Extended Learning, the Dean of their Behavioral Sciences group, and the head of their law enforcement program along with their law enforcement staff will be at the site on April 4th to look at can they actually move some of their professional staff, some of their professors, to teach at this particular site. One of the things that that I'm also happy to report is that in order to facilitate that and to facilitate the use of this site by all of the higher educational groups, one of the things that the county board back about 6 weeks ago approved is the construction of a fiber optic ring, which would put 48 strands of fiber throughout all of Scott County. But as a part of that project, it would connect all of our schools, all of our cities, all of our county buildings. It would also then connect us to Dakota County and connect us directly to the state, both through the 511 building in Minneapolis and also directly to Minnesota State University at Mankato. This site was included in that ring, so the training center will have fiber optic connections that connect it to those other sites and will make it entirely possible for Mankato, if the site works, and we can't say for sure that it will because they haven't been to the site yet, but for this site to work, for them to conduct training at the site and transmit it back to the university, or vice versa, to conduct certain training at the university and transfer it by a distance learning back to the site, because we will have a solid fiber optic backbone throughout both the county and also connecting there. That project is also, it's been approved by the board. Our RFP is on the street. It actually closes tomorrow. We should receive our proposals. We've had about 20 different proposers there. And we've coordinated that along with the state's Office of Enterprise Technology. They're heavily involved in that because they hope to also leverage that backbone to eliminate the T1 connections that they have coming into our county, and they would actually leverage then our connections going forward in partnership by providing some management of that network. So in terms of this facility, communication-wise, we've now put together and have funded a solid way to provide high technology training. In answer, Representative, to your question about federal homeland funding, we have made application for $750,000 primarily for technology through Senator Coleman's office. We do not know exactly where that application is at this point. It is still being processed, or it's going through their processes. And so I can't really tell you whether or not we will get that funding or not, but that funding has been requested.
Okay. Good. Representative Carlson.
Yeah, just a quick question. You said that Minnesota State or Mankato State had not been there to review the facility to see if it meets their needs. And maybe I missed something, but the request is to design and construct. Would you not include them to find out what their needs might be before you complete the design, or did I miss something with that?
Mr. Shelton.
Madam Chair, Representative, that you are correct in that it is to design and construct, but there is also a relatively large. There's about 48,000 square foot structure. It's actually the structure that's pictured here that exists. What they were looking for is to see how we may leverage that facility. So we haven't actually started any construction, and what we will do inside the facility is still in that design phase. We would be working with them, and that is the purpose of their visit to this particular site. We've met with them. We've brought the preliminary designs to them at their site in Mankato and gone through that. That is why they're coming out here now, is to take a look at this and see, will the site itself work? I don't know what their site considerations are, and then also to determine what type of tweaking we may do to some of our plans to accommodate what their needs might be. And it's our hope that we will be able to accommodate that and make it work. It would be very beneficial, we think, to them and certainly to the public safety providers in our community.
Thank you.
No further questions. Thank you very much. You have a concluding remark.
Thank you. Yes, Madam Chair, again, we enjoyed having the committee out 2 years ago and deeply appreciate the $1 million down payment on this regional facility, and we would certainly welcome having you out again. The people that put on parties in Scott County put on a pretty good show. You know that, Madam Chair.
And well, we made a note here.
Okay, good. We'll love to have you back. Thank you,
thank
members.
You. Representative McNamara.
Good evening, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair. Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would move House File 1207 for consideration and possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Representative McNamara.
Well, Madam Chair, it is a real pleasure to be back. I have had withdrawal since the 3rd of January. And I, Madam Chair, have missed this committee more than the members can possibly imagine. And I am glad for all the new members and the folks that are on this committee. And you'll have a great time, Madam Chair. I'm sure you'll have great tours next summer. And I just want to extend the invitation to you and the committee to come back down to Red Wing. As many of you know, we were there last year, Madam Chair. And with me is Otis Zanders, who is the Mr. Zanders. I want to get this right. Don't cheat. Don't say. He is not a warden. He is the superintendent of the Department of Corrections Red Wing facility. And what we're here to talk about, Madam Chair and members, is offender reentry and the importance of that in the community. And Superintendent Zanders has done an unbelievable job with folks from all the districts that we represent across Minnesota in taking young male offenders in the range of, I believe, in the ranges of around 16 to 21, if I'm not mistaken, maybe a one that's 22 or something like that, and has really done an awesome job. And what he needs is he needs some money from us. $6 million was in some of the, I believe, probably 03 numbers. So at some point, Madam Chair, after you get a chance to get down there and visit, we'll be looking at a newer number. It's in the design phase now. And I know we probably don't need to bore you, with all that stuff, but it's being worked through. They've selected a designer, so they're moving ahead. This is a an item of the bonding bill that was very important for Madam Chair, as you know, for former Chair Dorman and myself, that we thought it was really important. What happened is we ended up needing to fund the Faribault expansion, and they kind of drew up so much of the correction money that we were only able to fund the design. And so I look forward to the superintendent giving you a little presentation, and I'm sure to invite the great members of this committee back down to visit and see just the terrific work. And Madam Chair, they're also teaching them how to be in the green industry and the landscape business. So they're doing good things. So with that, Madam Chair.
Mr. Sanders, welcome to the committee.
There'll be some future pipe fitters, too.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, my name is Otis Sanders. I'm the superintendent at the Red Wing facility. First of all, let me thank Representative McNamara for your unconditional support at the visiting program. And naturally, I would like to personally extend an invitation to this committee to come and visit whenever your schedule permits. We'd love to have you down. The Red Wing facility, very briefly, is the state-operated facility for the state's serious, violent, and chronic juvenile offenders. To that mission, we house, again, a young man that's committed to our care, that's committed to the Commission of Correction, as well as condition of probation. But again, we are considered a higher sanction facility. As you know, and being a community correction-based state, we have a lot of lower-level sanction to keep our juvenile offenders at home. But when they fall through the cracks and they don't not seem to be amenable for treatment, we become the last stop in the juvenile system. It's a mission that we take very serious. At our facility, we have a plethora of treatment programs. We have to meet the needs of young men that's committed to us, whether they have sex offenses, substance abuse issues, mental health issues, as well as we wind those issues into mental health services and a strong transitional program. But no doubt, the backbone of our operation is our educational program. Every young man in our care is assigned to our education program, whether it's academic or vocational. With our program that we have in front of you today is to spearhead our transitional or to strengthen our transitional program to highlight our vocational program we feel is very imperative. Over recent years, the average age of our population has grown to be about average age at any given day is 17 and a half years old. So we are dealing with a young adult population. Many are transitioning back into independent living. So our vocational program has become a stronger offering that we like to do. We currently do offer 3 vocational programs. We would like to increase that. We work very closely with the technical schools, designing programs that we know that are marketable, as well as a young man can leave our program earning a living wage. Our proposal is to put a vocational building. It's because currently our vocational programs are scattered around our campus. They've been retrofitted into buildings that are built during the turn of the 1900s. We have retrofitted as much as we can. We have painted and what have you. And most of those buildings also does lend itself to a lot of remodeling because they're on historical registry as well. In addition to that, because they're not adjacent to an academic building, I do lose school time. I do lose some time of kids moving from an academic setting to a vocational setting. So, again, the proposal would connect this vocational building with our academic buildings, which would increase our security, increase the awareness, as well as allow us the opportunity to expand our vocational offering that we have. So there's a basic need for this vocational program. I'm definitely available to answer questions about our existing program, anything else the committee may have, Madam Chair.
Questions for Mr. Sanders, Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Sanders, I have visited Red Wing as a legislator. What vocational programs do you have? You said you had 3. That doesn't really offer you a lot of choices for these young men. And you know, it's been a while, so I don't remember the number of people you have down there in your care.
Yes. Mr. Sanders.
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Mahoney. Currently, our population is 130 juvenile residents on our campus. We do offer three programs as I speak, and those programs are construction trade programming, printing program, and metal fabrication.
What was the third?
Metal fabrication. And we also quarterly rotate that around. We also do some classes in welding as well in that metal fabrication program. With the additional program, we're looking at some other programs to allow us to connect more out of the pre-vocational program into full-fledged academic vocational, because at any given time, at least 30% of my population have received a GED or high school diploma. So they are in a work program and prepared to go into a full vocational program and that allow those credits to transfer into jobs with the trades, as well as receiving academic credit to go into an approved vocational school.
Well, Madam Chair, if I could just ask one. So could you be a little bit more specific with what you're trying, what programs you're trying to create down there? Yes, I do know some of your past visitors.
Yeah.
I've met them in a few places as a pipe fitter, construction pipe fitter.
Madam Chair, Representative. What we're proposing with the additional classroom space, again, I'd like to remind the committee, we'd like to retain those current offerings that we do have. But in addition to those, we see a tremendous need to add programs that deal with like commercial flooring, painting and decorating, drywall taping and finish, roofing, wiring, and blueprint reading. We also propose having a computer lab in that program to talk about soft skills and computer literacy and computer repairs as well. So those will be some of the additions that we'll be adding to this vocational program.
Thank you.
Representative Carlson.
Chair, Mr. Sanders, do you have your own instructors in that program, or do you contract, for example, with the technical college at Santa Rosa?
Yes, we do have state teachers that provide these vocational programs.
They're employed by your campus or the facility?
Madam Chair, yes, that is correct.
Are those programs then, what I'm thinking of is a young man that's maybe partially through the program and is released, are those programs articulated then with the Technical College of Minsky Systems so that they can transfer to another technical college, wherever their place of residence is, and continue and complete the program?
Mr. Sanders.
Madam Chair, currently we are what they call tech prep. We do get the coaching. Unfortunately, our current vocational programs does not have the licensure for the transference of credits. But that is the goal that for the new program, to establish their relationships, especially with the vocational school that's in the Red Wing area. We've had numerous discussions, so we're prepared to do so. But again, that would take a different type of licensure that we can move in that direction. We do feel that it's something that we want to take place to move out of the pre-vocational piece, so we can have those credits transfer. Again, one of the stumbling blocks has been that primary goal is to make sure that a kid that in that program, he has minimally received a GED or high school diploma. So those are our basic essentials of the program before they can graduate into the vocation area that we are planning on doing.
I understand that, but once they're there, I know with the prison system, some of their programs are articulated with the Minsky system and some of their specific campuses so that a person that's released can go in and complete their education if they're partway through the program. So I think that would be an important thing to do as you're moving forward and realigning the program to get that licensure, encourage your staff to do that so you can articulate those programs. I would say it's one thing with Red Wing, but I assume most of the residents probably will not remain in the Red Wing area. They probably will go throughout the state, and so I suspect it's important to have those programs articulated in a way where if they return to Minneapolis or St. Paul or St. Cloud or whatever, they'd be able to enroll and complete their program.
Madam Chair, yes, Representative, you're absolutely correct. And we have all similar plans, just like the adult Minnesota Technical Teaching College. Those credits get the correct licensure, so they would be the transfer to those colleges in that area. In addition to that, we're working very closely with the trade unions to establish apprenticeship type programs as well. So we are collaborating with the trades union as well as with the Minnesota Technical Teaching Colleges to make sure this transference take place.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Zanders, could you talk a little bit about your population, the offender population that you have, the offenses that they have, and how you're doing at keeping those folks out of coming back to your place or the adult correctional facility?
Mr. Sanders?
Yeah. Yes. Representative, as I mentioned earlier, that we do have a legislative mandated admission criteria for the young men that come to our program. Again, they're listed as appear to be a serious, chronic, or violent offenders. The average kid that comes to our program has an average of 10 out-of-home placement prior to coming to Red Wing. So we are dealing with the system highest hanging fruit. That being said, the young man that's in our care, they've a myriad of offenses. First of all, to be considered to become the Red Wing, I understand their stay there will meet the, if they were 21 years old, they would have been going to adult facility. They had that felony level of offense. So we talk about all of the offenses that you will see in the adult system, ranging from assault with a weapon, aggravated assault, burglaries. We have a lot of young men that come into our facilities, as you can imagine, that has been introduced to chemical abuse at an early age, whether they're self-induced or even to the point now we are seeing young men that with such brain trauma that's born with different type of addiction. So the profile of our individuals, not only are they seen to be by the courts not amenable for treatment, but these are young men that are coming to us with great degrees of dependency, multiple mental health issues and challenges that put a strain not only on their communities but as well as my resources as well. But that being said, this is a population that we feel that we put in an environment that's safe. We are at a point that they feel that we provide the basic needs that they are, that we are crossing the lines that prevent them from being productive in their home environment, which is not rocket science. But when you have a young man that's in your care, that you are ensuring that they get 3 meals a day, 8 hours of sleep, and they have no drugs, and they get large muscle exercise, so we see that obvious growth. But the measure that I'm thinking you're asking about, sir, is how we prepare this person to transition back home. And that is our greatest challenge and what we're very proud of. Internally, a level system that we identify all of the levels of changes that that a young kid is going through in our care. Through our cognitive program and our mental health services, our therapists, educational programs, we have managed to get a young man in an average length of stay of maybe 10 months to the transition phase. At that point, we do have a team of transition staff that a young man is on what we call extended furlough for 90 days. During this time, a Red Wing employee is having a minimum of once a week face-to-face meeting with this young man, making sure that he abides and adhere by the conditions of his furlough agreement. And also during this period of time, we're ensuring that if he's scheduled to be in school, he'll be in school. If he's scheduled to be at work, there's work in place. And again, all the conditions of that conditional release is met. So the services we have to meet this challenge, it's been a great challenge, but one that I think that we are definitely meeting the industry standards in terms of our success. A population that has been, I think, appropriately being used by our customers, the counties. It's a tremendous great understanding from court services as well as probation, how we're being used and what they expect from us. And I think that they'll be ready to show you that the successes that we've had is it exceeds some of the expectations. The young man that quarterly they received their GED or high school diploma or excelled to be recognized being on honor roll, as well as the one that expired to go on to greatness. I think we're doing a great job with that population.
Madam Chair.
Representative.
Thank you. That just kind of validates what we saw when we were down there talking to the folks. You know, what are you here for? It wasn't being incorrigible or disrespectful. These were some pretty serious offenses. that these young men are there for, and it's a tremendous program that you have going down there. It's a beautiful facility to go through. I hope we have the opportunity to go through again, because it's a beautiful facility, and you guys are doing great work, and I think a lot of that has to do with the respect that the folks who live there have for you and the program that you have, so you're doing a great job.
Madam Chair, thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Sanderson. On that note, thank you for coming before the committee.
Thank you.
And did I hear you say you'd be ready to move the minutes?
Yes.
Okay. Representative Tinglestad moves the minutes of this afternoon, right?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I am so impressed that Ms. Nissel was able to get them picked up already. And so I suppose our minutes have to show that these are the minutes of the afternoon meeting of March 13th, since we'll have a second set of minutes for March 13th. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Discussion of the minutes. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Minutes are approved. And Representative Scalzi.
Yes, thank you, Ms. Chair. And I would move to bring to the table House File 864 for consideration and possible inclusion in our final bill.
Representative McNamara.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And this bill is the Hastings Veterans Home Supportive Housing Initiative that, again, the design was funded in our last bonding bill, and this would be the construction money. And with me is the Minnesota Veterans Home Administrator Chip Cox, and I will let him explain the bill, ma'am. This is an important bill that would allow the veterans in Hastings are of a younger group than most of the veterans homes members who tend to be in Korean War, even World War II era. We have more Vietnam era, and now some of the potential for the Iraqi war veterans with challenges moving into our area. And the home would also be open to residents of the different veterans homes throughout, and all veterans, I believe, throughout the state of Minnesota. And so I'll let Mr. Cox explain it. But again, this is one of those things where we're reaching out to our veterans in a very positive way, trying to get them back into society. I think it goes along with the governor's initiative on homelessness and working on that, Madam Chair.
Mr. Cox, welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, thank you very much. I have a little bit of a cold, so I'll try not to break out into a coughing jag anytime soon. But thank you for taking the time to hear this. Again, my name is Charles Chip Cox. I'm currently serving as the interim executive director of the board. Prior to that, and still my shingle is hanging down in Hastings as the administrator of that fine facility. The Veterans Homes Board is made up of five facilities throughout the state. We have Minneapolis, Silver Bay, Laverne, Fergus Falls, and the home I'm going to talk about is Hastings, which is a 200-bed board and care facility, 200-bed board and care facility, licensed by the state of Minnesota. The residents that reside there do receive 24-hour care. As Representative McNamara said, the majority of them are younger. The average age of a resident living there is 56, although we have people living there as young as 22 years old. We do have two Iraqi war veterans living at our facility right now. Many of our residents have medical, mental health issues, post-traumatic stress syndrome, or chemical dependency issues. Many of the residents come for a short stay. They come to address their mental or physical health issues and then desire to return back to the community. Unfortunately, there's a shortage of safe, sober, and affordable housing available to them. So many of them return to the undesirable living situation that they came from. Many have limited income, limited family contacts. So as they get their mental and physical health back on track, many go back and live with a friend, some end up living in a shelter, some are homeless, and some just stay at the facility because there's nowhere else that they can afford to live. And living at a long-term care facility is quite expensive, and it's not a good use of taxpayers' dollars. Through this supportive housing program, we can provide affordable, safe, sober housing to the veterans of the state of Minnesota. What we want to try to do is keep them out of that revolving door, which ends up, they end up in a crisis center, a hospital, back to rehab, and usually back to the veterans' home again. And that's just, at times, can be a just revolving door that goes around and around. What we're proposing is that we build a 60-unit supportive housing program in two phases. The first phase would involve the construction of a 30-unit complex and hopefully an expansion someday to the full 60 units. These units would be a one-bedroom, approximately 600 square foot. Services offered to the veteran would include medication management, vocational rehabilitation services, mental health, chemical dependency support services, and social services. All these apartments would be handicapped accessible and provide our veterans with a safe and sober housing. These units could also be used for the polytrauma veteran that we're starting to see come back from the Iraq War. We want to be ready to care for our veterans in the years to come. There will be a big influx of Iraqi war veterans in the near future. We in the state of Minnesota need to be prepared to care for our veterans and our veterans with disabilities. This program is currently under design. Last year, as Representative McNamara said, we did receive money for funding of the design. I'm back here today to ask for an additional $7 million to build this facility for our veterans. Are there questions I can answer?
Questions? Sure. Mr. Cox, Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Cox, I would suspect that you probably have some kind of an estimate of veterans coming to the home and the need for the 30 units, particularly with veterans coming back from the Iraqi war now. I don't suspect that they come to the vet's home immediately. So, and I think 60 units of housing for our vets is probably not going to fill the need. So I guess what I'm trying to do is we are stewards trying to figure out long-term planning. It'd be nice to know, okay, we need 30 units this year, we need 15, 2 years from now, another 15. And if you have something like that, it could get it to the committee, to the chair, so she could share it, so we could see the, you know, long-term need as the veterans for the state of Minnesota, not just for Hastings. It'd be very helpful in the future. So it's not really a question, it's just a request.
Just a request for a broader.
Madam Chair, I will certainly provide that to the committee.
You. You know, Madam Chair, and Representative Mahoney, maybe I should ask Mr. Cox also to, not only for the transitional housing, and I think this might be what you're talking about, is the need for the domiciliary beds within the homes, what we see as a need growing in the future potentially within the whole complex might be good for the Chair and all the members to know about.
Representative Tingles. Oh, I'm sorry. Were you finished, Representative?
No, I'm sure this will come up again for years to come, and I want to be part of it, so I'll ask the questions then.
Representative Tingelstad.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And first I want to say thanks to Mr. Cox. I know you've been doing a great job as the interim director with the Veterans Home Board. It's been a very challenging time, and thank you for all your hard work. I appreciate that. My question is with the wondering if you've been working with the Housing Finance Agency to kind of look at some of the construction costs and see where that plays in with us.
Mr. Cox.
Madam Chair, Representative. We have talked to Minnesota Housing and Finance. We run into a problem. We want to care for veterans and veterans only and their spouses. We run into some problems when we want to do that with some of the rules and the guidelines that that agency operates by. Our veterans and the veterans organizations are not interested in having 51% of the people living in those housing units to be veterans and 49% non-veterans. On our campus, we serve veterans and their spouses. And that's been a stumbling block that we've been up against. Minnesota Housing and Finance is a fine organization, and they do very good work. We just want to care for veterans on our veterans' property.
Thank you.
Representative Peterson.
Madam Chair, thank you. I had the same question. And I know this question came up last year when this was before the bonding committee, and I heard a comment made by an authoritative source that the initial bid proposals that were coming in on pricing was substantially higher than what Minnesota Housing Finance Agency would do. And I'm just wondering if they are not available as a resource, why we wouldn't use them. And typically a bill like this would signify that the funding would go through them for this project. And this one doesn't. I'm asking the same question you just answered.
Madam Chair,
and
thank both Representative Tingelstad and Representative Peterson for that question. We did try in 2003, Representative Peterson, just before you arrived here in the legislature, to do that with through another means. And unfortunately, as Administrator Cox has said, the veterans organizations want the home to just be involved with veterans. They just feel that needs to be the concentration, and that's what the veterans' home should be and do. And the reality is those are the constraints that we're working within. And believe you me, I have expressed the same frustration that both of you have in dealing with this, but that we're trying to work within the reality that is before us.
Representative Peterson.
And the other five projects have been done in that fashion, historically?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Peterson, I think the only transitional housing, isn't there 20 units in Minneapolis, Mr. Cox? Am I wrong? Isn't there some veterans transitional housing?
Mr. Cox.
Madam Chair, Representative, there is a transitional housing program, but what we're talking about here is permanent supportive housing. As you know, there's a limit. There's a time limit on transitional housing. It's either 15 or 18 months or 2 years, somewhere in there. This is permanent housing. They can move in there and stay the rest of their life, and that's the difference.
But I do think Representative Peterson raises the question that was raised, and that is the dollar amount, and I think that's probably the significant issue here, too.
And, Madam Chair, it's certainly, I'm sure, your committees will do the job to look into that and see what makes the most sense. And I appreciate that. This is one way for us to help the vets. And, Representative Peterson, I understand completely where you're coming from.
Representative Scalzi?
Thank you, Ms. Chair. I was just kind of curious, maybe Mr. Cox can answer, is there any federal monies that come into a project like this, or is that only for just the veterans' home? Does that not work for supportive housing?
Mr. Cox.
Madam Chair, Representative. Currently, they will help build nursing homes, the 35% match. They will help build board and cares and nursing cares. They are not into supportive housing for financing. Did that answer it?
The federal dollars.
Yeah, the federal dollars would not be available.
Representative Honey?
Madam Chair, and to the members of the committee and to the veterans, and I see a couple of the hats out here, they're right. They are right. There's no need for non-veterans to be in this particular housing. I think we've all got a vet that we've talked to, and they talk differently amongst themselves than they talk with us.
Veterans want to, Madam Chair.
Mr. Cox.
Veterans want to live with veterans. And that's why the veterans' homes are so popular, and there's long waiting lists.
Just final comment.
Yeah, final comment.
Thank you very much, and I would very much want to extend the visit to the committee members. I know we've been down there a number of times before, and we've been lucky that this committee has been very gracious in the past to the whole veterans' home. And I will just say we are very lucky, as Representative Tingelstad has already said, to have Mr. Cox taking over this very tough task before the Veterans Home Board right now. Just because I will tell you, when you come down to visit in Hastings and see how well things work there, and I've been very close with the residents there, and many of them have been there, some for decades. I know some personally have been there for that long, 20 years. It just really works good, and as Representative Mahoney has said, we owe these veterans a really big thing. I really appreciate it. And Madam Chair, thank you for your gracious host of two bills. Good luck to the committee, and I do miss you.
Thank you. And my understanding is these last two bills that are linked, and do you want to present together? Is that my understanding, Representative Bigham?
I think we'll just do it immediately.
Madam Chair, yeah, I think that would be the preference to do it immediately. Yes, Madam Chair, I would move House File 1523 for consideration and possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I actually do have an author's amendment, which is the A07-0261, if I could.
Representative Scalzi?
I would move that amendment, the A07-0261.
Senator Scalzi moves that amendment to get the bill as the author desires. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, motion carries, and that bill is before you as amended.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Thank you for allowing me to present this bill, and on behalf of the co-authors of Representative Swales Bunn and Representative McNamara, we appreciate the opportunity to present this bill. The bill before you is a project of statewide significance. What it does is it requests an appropriation for improvements to the Minnesota Disabled Veterans Camp located in Big Marine Lake in Washington County. Since the camp started in 1926 for World War I vets, it has served to allow veterans to a place to relax and smooth into integration back to civilian life. This upgrade and expansion will allow the camp to serve a new generation of veterans who will be returning for more. We as legislators have heard the concerns from many of our stakeholders, the need to support veterans returning from the war. Since September 11, 2001, 12,000 to 15,000 Minnesotans have been called up to serve our country. 45% of the men and women serving in the 1st Brigade the Minnesota National Guard are married, and many of them have children. And we've heard that the reintegration is not easy after combat, and resources are needed to support that effort to reunite families. One initiative to support returning veterans and their families is to provide retreats as an opportunity to assist with those reunions. There will be a need for more facilities for family retreats, conferences for the various veterans organizations that are doing great work, and for individual veterans needing time to reintegrate into civilian life. I have a few testifiers here, one being the Washington County Board Chair Gary Kriesel, Washington County Engineer Don Thiessen, Don Dregans from the Veterans Board, Tom Rieger from the Building Trades, John Crawl from Anderson Window, who all be taking a moment, if you would allow, Madam Chair, to talk a little bit about their involvement in this project. And I just want to again thank the committee for their opportunity to present the bill.
Mr. Thiessen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. There's two handouts to you, and I just want to describe what they are. This one, that's the Big Marine Regional Park Reserve, shows how the Vets Camp fits within the county park system. Back in 2005, the legislature passed Senate File 467 that provided for our long-term partnership with the Veterans Rest Camp. And this is a schematic of our development plan for the park, and the Vets Camp is this upside-down L-shaped piece of land that then the next map shows the development plan for the Veterans Rest Camp. After a 2005 bill, Washington County worked with the Veterans Rest Camp to develop planned unit development, and this document is what that map is from. What this bill will let the Vets Camp do is to move ahead with the improvements that they have in their planned unit development. Example of things that are in that plan are a new lodge building with a gathering space for 150 people with meeting rooms, offices, a kitchen, a canteen, three outdoor pavilions for the Veterans of Foreign War, the American Legion of Disabled American Veterans, 14 new modern duplex cabins, 16 new single modern cabins, improving camping sites, 32 new boat slips, a new fishing dock, swim beach improvements.
And are you spelling over into the next, are you already taking us ahead to the big green part? No.
No, ma'am, Chair, I'm not.
Okay.
And also, as part of the vets camp, it's important that they have sanitary conditions there, so we'd be looking at new well houses that would be built, provide a safe drinking supply, and a new septic system, an RV tank system there. These are all, as I said, in the planning and development that the veterans prepared, and this funding will let them move ahead with those details, making that a reality. And as Representative Dignan says, for the, you heard from the previous bill, the number of vets that we have coming back to Minnesota. With that, I was...
Just take each of the tests, but they're all brief, you're saying?
Absolutely, Madam Chair.
And the next one?
I'm going to go with Washington County Board Chair Gary Kriesel.
Gary Kriesel, welcome to the committee.
Good evening, Madam Chair, committee members. I will try to keep my comments very brief. I know you're busy tonight, and I'm fortunate. I'm chairman of the Washington County Board of Commissioners. I also serve on the Disabled Veterans Rest Camp Board. I'm a United States Navy vet. I just want to say that the Washington County and the Veterans Camp have an excellent relationship. They both are undertaking improvements. The county, as a matter of fact, helped the Veterans Rest Camp with to develop their planned unit development. Anyone who has had the opportunity to sit through National Guard Deputy Chaplain John Morris's presentation on troop reintegration understands the importance of helping veterans reintegrate back into their community. As you probably all know, the veterans, our troops that serve in Iraq or Afghanistan, they end up with two families, the ones they leave behind, the ones they serve with, and then when they come back here, they're going to leave that family overseas behind, and it's hard for them to turn the adrenaline off. This camp is to allow veterans and families, there's no better healing power than veterans being with other veterans, and the security and the companionship, camaraderie that the veteran camp will bring forward. The Washington County Board of Commissioners unanimously passed a resolution of support for this funding, and we look forward to having a great relationship with them into the future.
Thank you. Mr. Kriesel, and the next one.
I'll have Don Dregans come from the Veterans Board.
Mr. Dregans, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. I'm a little longer-winded than he is. The Vets Camp was started in 1926 as a local farmhouse was donated to the disabled veterans of World War I. At that time, the original farmhouse was converted into a dormitory-type rooming house, and it took care of the shell shock victims of World War I. During World War II, shell shock was called battle fatigue. Today, it's called post-traumatic stress disorder, and we all know what that is. The main geographical area that the Disabled Veterans Rest Camp covers is the seven metropolitan counties. We have visitors, many visitors throughout the state and even other states that come and stay there. 4 years ago, we had a couple staying in cabin number one, and we found out that he spent 6 years in Hanoi Hilton over during the Vietnam War. He was a prisoner of war for 6 years over there. We gave him the cabin for nothing. Yeah. He served his time. The camp hosts many veterans programs. We have a Memorial Day program. We have a flag retirement day. Last year we retired with honor over 4,000 flags. We have a 4th of July ceremony and a Labor Day ceremony. We've got a 10-by-30 pontoon that takes the veterans and their guests out on the lake, Big Marine Lake, for fishing and tours. And also, we have the we host both the Hastings and the Minneapolis Veterans Home come up and go out on tours and have a picnic at the camp. Since 2003, the Disabled Veterans Rest Camp, Park Cottage Grove American Legion, and the Lions Club of Cottage Grove have sponsored an outing for over 50 mentally and physically challenged children, many wheelchair-bound. That pontoon I talked about last year had 13 wheelchairs on it with these little kids. And they have a regular fishing contest, and they come back and they weigh their fish. In fact, the person that was driving the pontoon is sitting in the back room with the person that caught a one-ounce fish. And you didn't dare throw that fish away, you know. So, I mean, it was, you know. The camp supports the Boy Scout Eagle projects, and they have completed projects at the camp. They've worked on our swimming beach. We've participated in the Minnesota Stand Down for Homeless Veterans. We've also provided a area for the Minnesota Air National Guard to conduct survival training for airmen that are going to be deployed. The return of the 3,000 Minnesota Reserve and Guard personnel that are going to be returning this summer, most of these citizen soldiers have children and spouses whose lives are again going to have to adjust to the return of the soldier, as well as a soldier adjusting to the family and the workplace. Defense Department statistics show that 30% of the soldiers and their family have some mental health issues 4 to 5 months after returning from overseas. That's not saying that they have PTSD or anything, but there's family problems and everything. The reintegration of these soldiers is an important project of the camp. There's a saying that if you went to war and you weren't changed, you were crazy before you left. Our job is to do all we can to make this transition of their lives back to the way it was when they were called to protect their freedom. There's going to be many challenges that these soldiers have to face. And, well, I'll say people, because there are many challenges that they must face, master, and accomplish. If you being replacing the stress of war with peace, relaxing, mind-cleansing thoughts to move beyond war, finding a meaning in life, and coming to peace with God and themselves and others. The others that the soldier's life affect are family, friends, and fellow workers can number in the thousands. In fact, I was given an information sheet today, and they figure that a conservative number of family members and others that are affected by each and every one of the soldiers is 25. So if you multiply that 3,000 soldiers that we've got coming back, the number gets up there. We've got 27 million veterans alive today, and we've got 420,000 in the state of Minnesota. And 70,000 of these have a service-connected disability. The DVRC's activities and program provide a place for veterans to enjoy comradeship with one thing in common. They're all veterans helping veterans. They can talk about their experiences and know that person they're talking to have some idea what his or her thoughts are. The rest, relaxation, and therapeutic value that the camp has is hard to measure. One example is a Marine, and I knew him personally, that at first, every time he heard a helicopter from home and field, he'd run into his camper. After some time during his stay at the camp, he felt relaxed enough he would stay outside most of the time. The proposed project we have 69 acres, and we only have 29 of it acres developed. The expansion will include additional 50 RV sites. It'll construct 8 new duplex cabins for 16 cabins, and it'll replace the six, the 12 cabins we have with six duplex. Two of these cabins will be completely wheelchair friendly. All will be wheelchair accessible, but two will be wheelchair friendly with the automatic entrance doors, the low countertops, the wheelchair shower, for a total of 28 cabins total. We want to construct the three pavilions that Don mentioned. We want to construct a lodge building, and along with this, we have to put in additional wells, a storm shelter, a shower house, add some additional trailers, and he mentioned the boat slips and what have you. We have already started with the permitting process, and we have a very good working relationship with Washington County. Before, and the reason that the camp is in disrepair is that we were mapped into this regional park that you have there, and the county has an, or I don't know if it's a Met Council, but has a stipulation that you could not apply for any permit. If you applied for a permit, it was automatically denied. Then if it went to an appeals board, and if the appeals board said you could have it, then the county had 6 months to buy us out, and we couldn't take that chance, not for the residents.
Well, Mr. Dregan, you've given very compelling testimony, and thank you very much.
Any questions?
No questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
And John Call?
Yep, John Call, and I'm going to have Tom come up with them, and they can...
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm going to be really brief and just say that I wear two hats, one of which is the County of Washington and the other is Anderson Window. And I want to inform the committee that Anderson Window is very interested in this project and has been talking about what they might be able to donate either in the way of windows or perhaps a grant. So that I just wanted to get that into the testimony.
Okay, good. Thank you. Yeah. Thank you. We're holding it to
him. And this is Tom Rieger with the building entries.
Rieger.
Tom Rieger.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. And I am the apprenticeship coordinator for the cement masons, plasterers for Minnesota, North Dakota, and Northwestern Wisconsin. I found out about this project. I read an article in the Minneapolis paper on September 26th, and Mr. Don Dregan's picture was in there. I read the article, and I saw that they needed help. And as a building trades person, leader in the union, especially with apprentices, I encourage community service work for apprentices to reach out with their skills and abilities to help the communities. I called Mr. Dragans and he asked me to send a letter because he didn't believe me. So I sent him a letter. I think he believes me now. And I've taken, I'm a son of a vet. I never served in the military myself. My dad was a World War II Marine, World War Pearl Harbor. And I was brought up to respect the vets. I heard about this camp and what a great project for community service for our apprentices, I thought. And I started reaching out to some of the other building trades unions. At this point, as of 4 o'clock this afternoon, I have 12 of the building trades unions on board to try to help out with labor. I've got the cement masons and plasterers. I've got the roofers, the bricklayers, the painters, the iron workers, the pipe trades. I've got.
He was holding his mouth.
Just out of respect, I'll say the plumbers, the pipe fitters, and yes, there is a difference between plumbers and pipe fitters, and the sprinkler fitters, the sheet metal guys, operating engineers, and the electricians. I've got suppliers, Apple Valley Ready Mix. Has offered to give a deep discount on the concrete that is needed for the end of the project that I'm going to work with. Several supply houses willing to give discounts, possible donations, depends on what. I've got 6 contractors on board. If I need any additional material or equipment, they're willing to step up to help. And the Minnesota Concrete and Masonry Contractors Association committed to me yesterday with their help for this project. I think with the help that I've been able to get through the building trades unions and the suppliers and contractors, along with hopefully the money that this camp can get, that we can really help these guys out. Just a little side story, I'm going to keep it within, you know, hour and a half here. I have an apprentice through the building trades, through the national building trades. There's a project called Helmets to Hard Hats, where if an apprentice comes in, an applicant comes in, they tell me they're military. I ask about Helmets to Hard Hats. They go to the top of the heap with the organization I represent. I had a young man that did a tour in Iraq and a tour in Afghanistan that came in today, and he brought his body armor in today. It was something. So we need to help these guys.
Well, this is an incredible bill to end a long day. Thank you. And Representative Tingelstad has a question.
Do you have enough of the event?
Oh.
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Okay. I'll just say a couple of words. I'm Michael Gerster. I am a veteran, and I came here initially to support the $1 million issue, but I was in opposition to the way it was originally written, and I want to thank our representative here for bringing it forward and amending it, so it went from a bonding issue to a general fund issue, so that the veterans could continue to own the camp. As far as I know, starting to research this a couple of years ago when we went through the saving the camp from condemnation, looking around, it seems that this camp is unique in the country. It is a 501c3 organization. The only people on the board are veterans. It is run for disabled veterans and then for other veterans and their families. As far as we know, there is not another camp in the country like that. We have another so-called veterans camp up north around Ely, but you know, it's a state property, and anybody could, if there's openings there, it doesn't have to be a vet to rent it. You know, you can go in and rent it as an ordinary civilian. So, but I want to thank you for coming forward with this. I want to thank the committee for hearing it.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. That is Mr. Gerster.
Yes,
Michael. Thank you,
Madam Chair. I'd just like to say thank you to this is a very much a community event here, as far as bringing in either corporate or building trades contractors. We just really appreciate the help and would appreciate the support and the definite consideration to be in the omnibus bill, because we really do need to work at giving our veterans a place to reintegrate back into civilian life. Are there any questions?
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative, when the bill was put forward in the last 2005, where the legislation was created that would prevent this from being taken with eminent domain, there was set up a planned unit development contract. How does this fit within that? And this is in my district, and one of the apprehensions that I have is that the board would like autonomy. They would like to be able to run this, make their own decisions, would not particularly want the county or the state stepping in down the road to tell them how they use the facility outside of the agreement set up within the planned unit development. There's a principle that which the government subsidizes it then later regulates. What assurances do you can you give me that the board will work within the planned unit development agreement that was written, it's actually a building code. It's a local building code that they operate within. What assurances have you looked at the planned unit development? Have you thought about potential conflicts down the road with the county or the state with subsidies either from here or down the road?
Commissioner Crystal or
Madam Chair and Representative Dean, I don't have any concerns about that. I have spoken, and I will let Commissioner and Chair of the Board answer that question, but I have no concerns about that, but I will let him just answer your question.
Commissioner Crystal.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Dean, the county's oversight would be directly tied to the auditory responsibility of the funding being spent on the PUD. The county helped the Veterans Rest Camp develop that PUD. The county has no other interest in it. The county has expressed that they have no desire to have any agency other than that over this funding. They welcome any other organization stepping forward. The Veterans Board has a comfort level with Washington County. There's a mutual respect and trust. I can say this, that it's important that the Veterans Rest Camp retain their autonomy. We're 100% supportive of that. At any time, would that be jeopardized? We would ask, even with the county support, that the funding not be there. I mean, we don't want the Veterans Rest Camp to lose its autonomy.
Absolutely. Follow-up, Representative.
Madam Chair, Representative, so there wouldn't be any requirements, for example, for maintenance or use of the facility?
No.
Maintaining the
Madam Chair, no.
Commissioner, please.
Madam Chair, for example, with DOT buildings or with county, there's maintenance standards that have to be upkept, and is there going to be any follow-up or policing from the county on the construction or the maintenance of these facilities or the use?
Madam Chair, Representative Dean, to my knowledge, the only oversight that the county would have on this would be that the money be spent towards the PUD. It wouldn't in any way try to tell the veterans what they can build, what they can't build. It would be in conjunction with that the funding be spent on what's in the PUD.
Anything
more? Madam
Chair. Representative
Mahoney? Madam Chair, Representative Dean brings up a good point. This is a very unique negotiated deal from a couple years ago. And a park like this, witnessed from its own history with the problems with the permits and the 6 months of eminent domain, it would be probably behoove both parties to set out a parameter of maintenance and upkeep so that both the veterans are served by saying, you know, you have to keep the buildings up to code or whatever it might be. And the county, you know, the county doesn't have to be overly crazy about it, and neither do the veterans have to be overly crazy about it. I think it's a pretty... With this unique of an arrangement, it might not be a bad idea on both parties. It's not a question; it's just a word of caution, because we don't know what the county or the state or the veterans might come to disagreement over 30 years from now. And the basic one they're saying is you have to keep the buildings up to current codes or grandfather codes or whatever you want to put it. That's the only thing I had to say. I think Representative
D
had a good point.
Representative Tinglestad.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have three quick things. Mr. Kreisel, you listed off a lot of the uses. It's very impressive. I serve on the Vets Committee, and one of the things we're hearing with the returning vets is that they need some kind of adrenaline rush for when they return here to make up for what they experienced in their deployment. I'm wondering if you're looking at paintball games, other things where there can be an adrenaline. Truly, that's a concern.
Madam Chair, Representative Thibodeau, that is an interesting concept, and that is true. I mean, that's why you see veterans when they come back from Iraq, they're driving 100 miles an hour down a freeway, and every time they hit an overpass, you know, they make that maneuver. So that's one of the things that Chaplain Morris had talked about. How do you replace that adrenaline, and how do you unwind it? You know, if I could, Madam Chair, just real quickly, to the concern about eminent domain, and that was never ever a serious position by Washington County. You know, it was a casual, unfortunate remark made by a Washington County Commissioner that had absolutely no support from the Washington County Board of Commissioners. And you know, we're not all fools. Nobody's going to try to take away the veterans' rest camp from the veterans. Myself, a vet, that's one of the issues when I ran for commissioner, that I would fight to keep the camp in the hands of the vets. That's where it belongs. And as long as I'm around, that's where my support will always be, to keep it with the veterans.
I think Representative Tinglestad had a couple more.
Two more. Quick
ones. Can I respond to that real quick, Representative? Just two things on that. I think that's a great idea, Representative Tinglestad, and I think the Veterans Board, who would be able to deal with these details, should be able to decide that. The other thing is, I will go on record, Representative Dean, saying that I have voted as a former Cottage Grove City Council member against the use of eminent domain. I asked that question while I was not here. I am aware of the history, and I don't support eminent domain. So I'm telling you that it shouldn't be a concern.
Madam Chair, could I make one final remark?
Well, I think Representative Tinglestad has not quite
a couple of quick questions, yeah. Procedural kind of stuff. On line 9, it talks about increased capacity, amenities, access, and safety, and your bill is for $1 million. Is this the project in total, or will you be back asking for more funding?
Madam Chair, Representative Tinglestad, the total cost is $1.2 million, and we are asking for $1 million, and as you heard, there are some organizations out there that are willing to, you know, that are going to help and be very gracious with their time and resources. So my intent is that this is it. So for the $1 million,
I think there's one more
procedural question, Madam Chair. With the amendment on it, it switches it from bond proceeds to general fund administered through the Commissioner of Administration. So procedurally, I'm wondering if this needs to go to State Government Finance since it's under admin. And I don't know if you thought through that. I know the motion that Representative Scalzi made was, you know, to lay it over for possible consideration, but maybe there needs to be something adjusted with that.
We need to take a look at that, so maybe before the next meeting we can
decide on that,
make a decision about that.
I serve on the State Finance Committee, so
oh, great.
I'd be.
Yes, Phyllis.
Chair.
Representative Mahoney.
Madam Chair, and Representative Bingham, neither Representative Dean nor I were implying or talking about eminent domain. I think what both he and I were talking about is a long-term vision, a long-term plan for the park. And neither one. I don't necessarily dislike eminent domain. I kind of think it's a tool that government should have, but he may not, and no one else may, but that's okay. That's not what we were talking about. We were talking about a long-range agreement that protected both parties in the long haul.
Madam Chair, Representative Mahoney, I wasn't referring to the comment that you and Representative Dean had made regarding the long-term plan. I was referring to the comment way in the beginning when he asked me the question about, you know, the use of eminent domain, of which the commissioner responded to. And I just wanted to let him know that I don't support the use of eminent domain for the economic benefit.
Were you finished?
Yes, thank you.
I think we are finished.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And we are going to... Representative Bunn, I believe, last bill.
I would thank you, Ms. Chair. I would move House File 1243. to come for consideration and for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Zaskowski moves House File 1243. Representative Bunn, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and that's kind of a hard act to follow. First of all, it's been wonderful to see some of the veterans from our area. My father also is a World War II veteran and has spent my life listening to the stories and the relationships he developed at that time. What this next component is and why it is associated with this is that you were shown this map. And the Big Marine Park is kind of a big boot, and it surrounds the veterans camp on three sides. So the veterans camp is within it and along the shoreline, and the access, I believe, is fully through the Big Marine Park. I'm going to correct you on that. And so what this bill does is, as this new improvement is taking place at Big Marine, at the veterans camp, sorry, I have three bills up tonight, so I'm going to... As these improvements occur in the camp, the county, in conjunction with the Veterans Camp, has a grander plan for the park and the camp. And the county is proposing here a $1 million appropriation for bond proceeds to improvements, roads, trails, for the access to the camp, the path to that. And I'm going to let the county engineer explain that in greater detail.
Mr. Thiessen.
Good evening again, Chair, Committee. Representative Bunn referred to this map that shows the Big Marine Regional Park Reserve, and this really gets to some of the questions that were earlier about how are we going to coexist in partnership. The access road into the Big Marine, into the Veterans Rest Camp, is shown up here towards the top. It's you also see a note that says bridge crossing over Veterans Access Drive. Part of that bill in 2005 gave the county easement to cross the Veterans Access Road so that we could access the parkland on the north side of the Red Square. And this is a park setting. Well, it says bridge there, but what we're looking at constructing, the terrain is perfect for it, is really a large arch pipe that would let the Veterans Rest Camp enter, and we even talked before this hearing about how we could do some decorative work on the concrete to let people that are coming into the Vets Camp signal at the arc entering into the Veterans Rest Camp. And then the park visitors would go across the top of that. The last thing we want is something that looks like a bridge. We want it really be a park setting. And what this does is protects the safety of the people using the Vets Camp. You won't have to have worry about parks visitors if it was an at-grade road crossing. Oh, I wonder what's down that road. And they go down the road into the Vets Camp. At the same time, we are working with the Vets Camp, so the amenities that we're building in the county park, they can access those like our bike trails, swim facilities, and that. So the Vets Camp also users can get some bang out of the county improvements that are happening there. So this is an improvement to the access, not only for the Vets Camp, but also our regional park. And it really helps, they say, make our partnership work for the long term out there.
And Madam Chair, that's basically the extent of what I was going to present. Make it short because it builds on the kind of information you heard previously, but glad to take questions.
Questions for Representative Bunn? Representative Engelstad?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Bunn, similar question to the previous one. So the $1 million in bonding, is there any additional costs? Will you be back next year to ask for extra funding?
Not in relation to this project, no.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Dean?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Mr. Thiessen. The $1 million for that type of structure, is that realistic from your experience? It seems a little late.
Mr. Thiessen?
Thank you. Madam Chair, we haven't done detailed engineering yet, Representative Dean, but from our experience, it's not 100% of the cost, but certainly there will be some county participation that also it is a regional park. It's going to benefit that. Typically, these are around $750,000. This one will be a little bit more expensive. So we feel comfortable that it's really we thought it was a reasonable request considering the benefit to the state and the region.
Anyone else?
Madam Chair.
Representative Tinglestad?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Thiessen, so this is part of the Metropolitan Council's regional parks. And so was there a separate request through their funding program with Met Council Park Funding?
Mr. Thiessen?
For this project?
We have not made a separate request through that process.
And why not?
Because this is such a friendly committee.
Not only is he smart, he's quick on his feet.
Well, Madam Chair, if I could take a stand. Thank you. Well, good answer, but, you know, I've carried the Metro Council bill for several years, and Representative Scully has it this year, and, you know, there's the whole procedure that all the counties go through, and, you know, to have one project jump ahead of another one, you know, it's not the process, and I don't know if there's extenuating circumstances, but, you know, my park in Anoka County needs some stuff, and I'm not submitting separate bills for my county park, so...
Well, Madam Chair, in all seriousness, this is not a clean regional park improvement. If this was a bridge over the access road into the park, it'd be different. But what we're talking about is an improvement that really benefits the Veterans Rest Camp. And mm-hmm. so it's tied to the previous bill you heard. So it's not a clean, pure improvement to the regional park system. And that mm-hmm. is the real reason we separated.
So it would be infrastructure through this one to get to the other one, would you say? Is that...
Correct, Madam Chair. We're crossing Vets Camp property. They own the road, and we just have an easement across that.
Further questions?
To make that a little clearer, it's to make sure that the access for the general park visitors and the veterans park is clearly delimited, that the two are separate, but in the same positioning, but separate and delimited, so that there would be no confusion about that. And so again, this is part of the Vets Camp related to the Vets Camp proposal, and therefore has more statewide significance. It's not just about a regional park; it's for access from people all over the state.
Good. Well, lots of heavy stuff tonight, and the next meeting we're on to some education issues, higher ed, and other things. So,
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you just remind us when we'll be meeting in the next week here?
Our next meeting on Thursday, March 15th. The usual time, 2:15, and then we have one more meeting on 12:30 on Friday.
And anything scheduled Monday, Tuesday?
No. Okay. Well, I mean, other than assuming, and again, you know, some of this is tentative, but Monday it would be at 2:15, and Tuesday would be 2. Now, Tuesday is our normal right. time. So the two extra meetings are 12:30 on Friday and 2:15 on Monday.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Hopefully we don't go on into the evenings.
So watch the website.
Yes. Right. Meeting is adjourned.